Here we go again, episode 217 of the Legion of Reason Diversion. We have with us tonight a special guest, Lalo Degach, who is a Chilean American, I assume, but he was born, I know he's born in Los Angeles. Yeah. And we're going to have him in a couple of minutes. He's just updating his Mac OS, and we'll pull him into the discussion. In the meantime, I was in Saskatoon last week.
Right.
And I was, you know, representing atheism in a multi-faith panel, which was a lot of fun. I think I'm the only one that was worth listening to. But you be the judge. Eventually, I'll find the link to that event, and I will post it. And we'll, you know, I'll let the chips fall as they may. I don't understand. But the Muslim representative on there was just pulling quotes from the Quran, and I'm like, oh, well, who cares? And of course, a load of sophistry from the Christian representative. And so it was a lot of, I thought it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I got, of course, being the atheist, only atheist there that anybody knew of, even though my mother was there and my brother and a good friend of mine who was taking pictures because I wanted some photographs of the event. And we, you know, I got a lot of attention because, you know, as I said in the talk, there's nothing that unites a room full of people from diverse religions than when an atheist walks into the room, because it's like all of a sudden all the differences in their religion kind of disappear and they have a united front against some non-believer. Well,
right.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
So what was the main topic then? Was that the main topic?
Well, there were three questions. One was, who am I? And I talked about all the events that had to happen, such, you know, the Big Bang, the formation of stars and galaxies, the creation of heavier elements in from the first stars that, and, you know, of dying stars that seeded the galaxies with these heavier elements that are required for life. That was one of them. What does it mean to be a moral person?
Nice.
And there was one other question. And I'm trying to remember what it was. But the last part was convincing people why they should be, you know, whatever. In my case, it would be atheism. I actually took that time and didn't try to convince people to be atheists. I tried to convince them to be skeptics.
Nice.
Scientific skepticism. Because I believe scientific skepticism leads to atheism anyway when it's applied to religious claims. But that also can be applied to all sorts of things like Reiki, chiropractic, homeopathy, etc. It's not a specific belief or specific system for assessing just religious claims. It's just one of the many
thinking.
Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I read the passage from Carl Sagan's book, The Demon Haunted World, where he talks about the dragon in his garage.
Nice.
So it's a great example of why I don't accept religious claims, because it's a endlessly receding, from a religious person's perspective, it's an endlessly receding God. You know, it's receding into unfalsifiability and untestability. And that's my position. I strongly believe that.
So how about the morals? How did that go over? Like, did everybody just say you have to believe in God to have morals except you then?
Well, that was my point, is that you do not have to believe in God to actually be a moral person. I don't believe that for one second, of course. In fact, I brought up the Euthyphro dilemma, which is one where either it's moral because God says so, or it's moral outside of God and God's just the messenger. Either way, God is, you know, if it's the former, for instance, God is, it's just, he can change his mind. Whatever is moral is defined by what that God says. Well, God can change its mind, and it becomes, divine command becomes just God's whim. If it's the latter, it's, we could figure it out for ourselves. Thank you very much. And, you know, no need for God. So that was my point. I was listening to something. Did you listen this morning to the So You Think You're a Skeptic podcast?
No, I saw it going on. There's been some political drama happening with Greg Clark stepping down as party leader. So it's been a distraction.
Yeah.
It's been a bad distraction. So.
Okay. Gannett.
I would have been more fun to listen to that. How did that go?
Oh, what a terrible bunch of arguments. I'm just adding Lalo Degach here. Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, he was talking about claims, you know, like scientism, for instance. My biggest problem with the whole... Hi, Lalo. We're here. Yeah, I'm just talking about claims. Hey, sorry. And
Sorry. My computer's... It looks like it's saying now it's going to... It'll start again in 40 minutes.
We got 40 minutes. Okay, awesome.
No, I'll just switch after my computer is updated. I'll just stay on my phone for right now.
Okay.
Yeah, you sound good.
Yeah, you sound really good on the computer. Yeah. So I'd love it. Just let me finish this one little thought on this morning's discussion on So You Think You're a Skeptic podcast. They had a Christian on who used to be a scientist, used to be an atheist, so he says. And he was saying that, complaining about scientism, you know, that all claims have to be met with evidence. And he brought up the idea of the value of art. And I'm like, but that's a subjective claim. God exists is an objective claim. There's a big difference between those two things.
What does art have to do with that, though?
Well, he was trying to equate... Well, I'm not equate, but he was trying to get out of the whole problem of having evidence by saying that not all claims require empirical evidence. But the problem is that he's making a category error in saying that, just because art is a subjective... You know, appreciation of art is a subjective thing, that all of a sudden he can equate God exists with a subjective claim. And it's just like apples and oranges. There's an objective claim like that. I mean,
I'm not sure what he means, though. It's just like, because art is subjective, whether somebody thinks it's good or bad art doesn't mean mass doesn't attract other mass, like with gravity.
Right.
The calculation for gravity still stays constant. Even if you think, like a movie.
It's true for you. If it's true for you and it's true, it must be true for all people, then it's an objective
claim. But then if it's subjective, then you can believe or not believe in God. Like, you can like or not like art. Like, his that backfires then.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing is, it's a category error. You can't arbitrarily declare that your claim is subjective and immune to being, of the requirement for actual evidence. And that was,
I can say
that
art is ugly and God doesn't exist too. Yeah. Just as simply as he can say art is beautiful and therefore God exists. Like,
it's really bad logic. And I was just,
bad logic.
I wanted to bring that up on that podcast with him, but I was hoping. I was there were so many logic fallacies in the whole thing. I was basically rapid firing in my comments. I don't know if you saw how many comments I made on that. I'm just come on. Yeah. Anyway, Lalo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to formally be introduced to everyone. So I know you,
absolutely.
Randy.
Yep. And we have Twyla here. The feisty
Twyla. Twyla stuck feisty in the Twyla. Bible Belt redneck.
Yes. Yeah, she's in between Edmonton and Calgary. So if you look in an atlas, you'll see where she is, and she's kind of in redneck country. This is kind of...
Where is this?
It's in Alberta. It's in Alberta.
Central Alberta.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she's in redneck country, both... And Christine, who is the internally misogynized Christine. She is here in Calgary as well. So Calgary and Edmonton are oases of non-belief.
Secularism.
Yeah, yeah. They really are. Yeah. I mean, you step out, I'm evil. you step out of Calgary or Edmonton and you are in Jesus land. I mean, it's Arkansas North here.
I wouldn't say Banff and some of the, you know, resorty places.
Well, mostly Australians.
and Asians.
What about the Asians?
Yeah. Good sushi places in Banff. Anyway, Lalo, you and I are actually, you were probably only born a few miles from me. I was born in Long Beach.
Nice.
Which is pretty close.
I grew up kind of in between the border between Burbank and North Hollywood.
Okay. I was in Whittier. That's where I grew up. Or a little bit, anyway. Mm. My early childhood. Then I got transplanted at the age of five to Winnipeg and met with ungodly cold. It's one of the coldest places. You know, they called a place on Mars Winnipeg because of how cold it was there.
In the polar regions of Mars, it must be very cold, right?
Well, it was one of the places that one of the rovers went to.
They called
it Winnipeg. I'm not sure how it works, but yeah. So, Lalo, tell us about your podcast, the podcast.
Lalo the Gosh. Yeah. Well, it took me a while to choose a name for the podcast, but
that was clever.
A friend of mine. I mean, I was going through a ton of names because I, you know, wanted something interesting but something diverse because I wanted the podcast to be versatile so I can touch on different subjects. And eventually a friend of mine convinced me, like, you know, your name is very unique, especially in the community you move in. I've yet to find many other Latinos, especially like Arab Latinos like myself in this community. So I decided to call it the Law of the Gosh podcast. And mainly what I focus on is interviewing people who have experience in very extreme forms of religion or cults or ideological groups. I've been mainly focusing on Islam because one, I find the subject very interesting. So I'm studying a lot about that ideology. And also I find that the people who have left Islam or sometimes are still in a Muslim majority country usually don't get very much attention from the mainstream media and even alternative media, not really that much either. So I decided to talk with them, and actually because they get ignored so much, they're usually very happy that I want to talk with them, so that helps me. But not necessarily just Islam. I've talked with people who have grown up in Mormonism. The first podcast I did was with a person who is an ex-neo-Nazi who was in jail and used to belong to skinhead gangs. And Joshua Turner, I interviewed him twice. Different things like that. So I, but myself, I'm not a person who comes from religion or any kind of ideological group, really. My family is very science-oriented. My mother was a nurse. I mean, both my parents are retired, but my mother was a nurse and my father was a physicist. And my grandfather was a physicist and my brother is a physicist. And I have a lot of family that are in science. I didn't study science. I first studied film. And then I did my postgraduate in international politics. And I was never brought up in any kind of religion. I'm an atheist lifelong. I actually discovered that there were religious people who believed in God, I think it was pretty young, maybe like age 5 or 6. I mean, I don't remember the age, but I remember meeting the first kid who told me he believed in God, and that kind of, I thought he was the only one. I thought this was like a child who believed in Santa Claus, you know, like you meet when you're little and you don't believe anymore, and you meet a kid who does, and kind of think, oh, he's crazy. I met a kid who believed in God. I knew about religion. I mean, I knew about, you know, Christianity and in Jesus, and I knew there were people who belonged to religion, right? I knew people said they were Catholic or Protestant, but I thought this meant kind of an ethnic background kind of thing, if you know what I mean. Like somebody telling you they're mm-hmm. Korean or something. I thought, like, you know, in origin, you know, my ancestors were this, right? And I even knew my family was Catholic, so I'm like, then we celebrate Christmas. But they didn't, you know, we didn't go to church and no one took it literally. So I thought it was funny when I met a child who believed in God, and I kind of laughed about it, and I told other kids and other people, and I said, he believes in God. And they said, well, I do too.
So it should be.
And it really freaked me out. And actually, I asked my dad, wondering, maybe my dad believes in God. And I was scared to ask him because I'm like, what if my father is insane too? Because I'm like a 5-year-old thinking everyone around me is insane, right? And so yeah.
I had the same experience.
Same with me. That almost parallels mine too.
It's kind of funny, like my experience is almost the polar opposite to most of the people I talk to, because they said they never had met when they were younger a person who was an atheist. So I asked my father if he believed in God, and he said no, and I was alleviated. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, thank my parents are not crazy. But I remember I have vivid memories of even being very little, maybe like 7 or 8 years old, and a teacher talking about God and religion, and in a way that she believed it was true. And I'm thinking, oh my, like, she's insane. Like my teacher's guilt. So religion, when I got older in my teens, it wasn't something I was too interested in. It was something I mostly ignored. But the more I studied politics and traveled around the world, I saw the importance religion had in societies everywhere. Mm-hmm. And at some point I started to focus on it more, and well, how I got thrown into this is another long story, so I won't bore you guys in that.
Now I
try to make sense of the world and the insanity I see.
You've traveled a lot around the world, and so I think that's an important thing, that to make these comparisons between, you know, the United States, or, you know, you've studied in Korea and you've been in Japan. There's big differences between these places in terms of how religion affects society and politics.
Yes. I mean, I was born in the U.S., where I lived until I was about 12 years old. Then I moved to Chile, where I went to junior high, because I started at like 7th grade. And then I did high school, 2 years of college. And then I went back to the States and got my bachelor's there. And then I went to Korea and also studied in the university there. And then I went to Japan and studied there. And I was a little bit in Hong Kong. And then I wanted to do a postgraduate degree. But after living in Asia, which is very far from Chile, which is where my parents were through all this, we're talking like a 35-hour flight. I decided to be with my family again and do a postgraduate in politics, because I'd become very interested in politics at that point. Back in Chile, where I've been now for the better part of a decade and live mostly here. And so, yeah, all these experiences have oriented my thinking quite a lot, especially being a person of diverse background, being born in the U.S., but lived in Chile. Both my parents are Chilean, but on my father's side, they're of Palestinian-Chilean background, and the Chilean-Palestinian community is quite big. It's the fourth largest diaspora Palestinian community mm-hmm. in the world is in Chile, which I found out a lot of people don't know. It has, I think, about 5 times the amount of Palestinians that you'll even find in the U.S. And this is only a country of 17 million people. But Arabs in general in Latin America are quite a lot. One of the biggest populations of Lebanese people you'll find is in Brazil. I think about 6 million people of Lebanese background. Something very particular about all the people from Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, which are the main ones that you'll find Arabs in Latin America, is that almost all of them, quite close to 100% percentage, is that they're of Christian background. And most of them came in the early part of the 20th century, just like my family did. So there's a big disconnect in for me with the Palestinian background there, because we're talking about my great-grandfather coming from Palestine. But there is in Latin America, because of the quantity of Arab people, you'll find still that there's a lot of Arab culture of food and whatnot. Some people can speak Arabic. I can't, because my father couldn't. But you'll find a lot of Arab culture, but it has nothing to do with Islam. Nothing at all. Like, there's nothing Islamic in the Arab culture you find in Latin America, because almost all of them are of Orthodox Christian background, or they've converted to Catholicism over the generations being in Latin America. So you don't find the problems that you typically hear about with Islamic communities, correct? Like FGM, or trouble with apostates being killed or anything. Nothing like that. This is totally alien to Arab communities in Latin America. So that being said, that being a fact, it's actually not enough that a lot of people highlight the fact that Islam is not a race. It's also not a culture, which I think some people get confused on. Arab culture is not ingrained with Islam. In fact, some things about Arab culture are contradictory to Islam. For example, there's Arab music, but music in Islam is prohibited. Right. Yeah. Belly dancing is obviously very haram, very, you know, prohibited in Islam. So there's a lot of aspects about Arab culture, or the cultures of other countries outside of anything Arab, like Indonesia. It's just one aspect. I wouldn't say that everything about American culture is Christian. You could not be Christian at all. You could be Buddhist or Jewish or any other religion and still be completely culturally American. Now, there's a lot of obviously mix there. There are Christian aspects about American culture that have mixed, right? That you would say is part of American culture, which is kind of an origin Christian, but not entirely. There's a lot more to culture than just religion. So that's something I like to highlight, because the Arab community of Latin America, because you don't hear about the same kind of problems with Islam, we tend to get ignored, which is kind of messed up, right? Because we're well behaved, you don't hear about us.
Yeah. 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 So what about Chile? It's has a, well, it was conquered by the Spanish in the 16th century.
Yes.
And it is ostensibly Catholic. Is it pretty much pervasive within society in your country?
It is the main religion. I would say the religious aspects of Chile have diversified a lot over the years. There's also a big evangelical community in Chile. I forget how much they are. I think they're about 10% of the population, which is pretty significant. You'll find some other countries in Latin America, like Ecuador, that are 100% Catholic or 99% Catholic, like very close to the absolute is Catholic. And Chile is not like that necessarily. Catholics, I think, are about 70% or so. But a recent poll that from about 2 or 3 years ago showed that almost a quarter of Chileans are non-religious. So that's not necessarily atheist, because a lot of kind of new wave spirituality is very popular in Latin America. A lot of aromatherapy, and you'll find crystals, a lot of homeopathy. Yeah, homeopathic pharmacies and junk science like that. Actually, firm belief actually is very uncommon. Even among Catholic people, it's very uncommon for me to find people who still practice their religion very fervently, like go to church and read the Bible. People will identify as Catholic, but with no real practice. There are people who are extremely religious. I even have evangelical family who are very hardcore about their religious belief. But like everywhere else in the world, it's very associated to underdeveloped parts of Chile, less more marginal regions,
more rural
of the country, rural areas in Chile, and it's the same thing you'll find everywhere. Even in the United States, it's like that. That's why you refer to the Bible Belt, of course. But it's a country of a where there is now a lot of religious diversity, but the Catholic Church still has a lot of power over government, and even when policies are debated, for example, abortion or gay rights, still Catholic priests still hold quite a lot of weight, and they're interviewed and they have a lot to say. Yeah, not in a way that I see in the United States. It's not that I see priests constantly interviewed on TV when abortion is debated, right? It's maybe a religious politician, but not a priest. Yeah. But that's what you'll find in Latin America still, where priests or bishops are still hold weight in that way.
Yeah, it's Canada is kind of a quarter that claims to be Catholic. I'm not sure how much of that quarter of the population really is Catholic, fervent as opposed to culturally Catholic. You hear the bishops here a lot. I mean, we had a bishop here in Calgary that was very outspoken. He actually made Jerry Coyne's book on the subject of atheism, and his name is Fred Henry. I won't use his, but I the middle name that I've given him is not very nice. He very much toes the Catholic line. And, you know, we're heavily into the medical assistance in dying debate that's going on here. That it's legal now, but it's only for terminally ill patients where death is foreseeable, whatever that means. And we've heard the Catholic bishops speak out very strongly against it. And, well, I feel like if I'm hearing the Catholic bishops saying something, I think the right decision is to do exactly the opposite of what they say. And it's amazing how much of that is right. You know, like what would Fred Henry do? And I'd do the opposite. I agree with nothing that the Catholic Church here in Canada says in terms of where politics and society intersect. We're dragging them kicking and screaming. I mean, at least in Canada, forward, yeah.
Well, now we're almost forward. Wanting to get rid of them because they're just, you know, intervening in things like GSA groups and schools and this kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're very meddlesome, and they ought to be, if they're going to lobby, they should be taxed, like a lobbying group.
Yeah.
Well, there was an investigation.
Against vaccines, and Ken Ham's coming to Red Deer in April.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Because that's amazing. Of the Catholic homeschoolers.
Yeah,
he's not Catholic, is he?
No, he's not. He's.
But the homeschooling group that's bringing him is. Well, why else would they bring Ken Ham?
Well, but it's not necessarily Catholics that are homeschoolers.
Oh, yeah. It's not the Catholics.
It's the Catholic schools. It's the evangelicals or whatever. Like, it's a small but vocal group, right?
Yeah, the homeschoolers are all evangelical.
The Catholic schools that are publicly funded in Canada as well.
Yeah, actually, education in Chile, is that a public responsibility?
I mean, the whole subject of education in Chile has been probably the subject in the last decade. It's a very complex issue. I've heard news reports in the United States that refer to Chile's educational system as entirely privatized. That's not true. Absolutely not true. There are schools, high schools or how do you say everything before university in English?
Secondary post, you know, not well, se- well secondary school. Yeah. Eight, you know, primary and secondary
school. Schools in Chile kind of work a little bit differently. One school has kindergarten to the last grade of high school in one school.
Okay.
So that's different from, I know the U.S., like, they divide up schools. Like, one school is junior high, another school is high school. But a lot of those schools in Chile are are public. In fact, some of the best high schools in Chile are public. And there are public universities as well. But a lot of it is privatized, much more than you'll find in the U.S. In the U.S., going to private school is kind of something for the elite, while in Chile, it's the majority of people go to private schools. And it's the majority of schools that exist. So not everybody has the option to go to a public school. And education is expensive. And I know in Chile, a lot of people complain about how expensive university is here. But when you compare it to American universities and how much Americans pay,
it's crazy.
It's nothing. It's not even close to that. You know, it's not even a tenth of what Americans pay if they don't get a scholarship. So a lot of the new student movements in the last 10 or 15 years have been pushing for education to be 100% free, which actually means socialized, but in Chile they'll talk about free education. But yeah, it's been a big subject, and a lot of the leaders actually of that movement are nominally and very fervently communist leaders. They belong to communist parties officially. I'm not like calling them communists in a derogatory way. They belong to communist university groups. They belong to the Communist Party of Chile, which still has some power. It's not like in the U.S. where, you know, kind of used in a derogatory form, you call a socialist maybe a communist. This is a formal communist party. In Chile, communism still exists, and there is a communist party, and they hold some seats in the Congress, but they don't have enough power to really move Chile anymore towards communism entirely. So they often do it in a very stealthy way often. But it's not, it's not the divisiveness you'll find in Venezuela right now.
Which
is a completely different story. Chile is mostly been economically very stable in the last 30 years, almost 40 years now. It's the best economy in Latin America by far. And actually, we're getting a huge amount of immigration, which is starting to become a big subject now in Chile. Because of the stability of the economy, we're getting a lot of people from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Brazil, from Argentina, because Argentinian economy has been a disaster for the last 20 years. And a lot of people from Haiti now, too. And especially the people from Haiti have become kind of a big subject in Chile because they're culturally probably the most different people we'll find. And Chile doesn't have a very big black population. And they don't speak Spanish. Right. Which is very unlike the other immigrants we'll get, like Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, and even Brazilians speak Portuguese, which is close enough that it's easy for them to learn. But the immigrants from Haiti, it's very hard for them to learn Spanish. So that's been a Yeah, they speak French, but it's kind of it's Creole, and it's very different kind of French, I think. I don't know much about it, but I know their adaption here to Chile has been kind of hard. I actually have an aunt who works in kind of helping them integrate into the country. But I should highlight that in my experience and from what I see, and even on the news, you'll find very rarely are criminals immigrants. Like from Brazil or Argentina or Venezuela or even Haiti, they're usually extremely honest people. They're very hardworking. And any kind of news of criminality, of people getting held up or robbing banks or violent crimes, is usually a Chilean.
So it's not like what's happening in Europe right now, where you have a lot of the immigrants that are the economic immigrants that are being a bit of a problem. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I mean, depend. I mean, yeah, you're back now. It might depend on the country they're coming from, but you know, in Chile, I wouldn't say criminality because of immigration has been a problem. The only problem is Chile is not a very big country, and it's all centered around Santiago, and Santiago is basically a big valley which has a limited amount of space. So there could be a congestion problem in Chile. It's not there yet that immigration is becoming a problem, but people are starting to worry it could build up to the point where it could be.
Yeah. So
can I ask a question? Is that more an infrastructure type issue, or is there like a tinge of racism, I guess, in there? Something like that, right?
Racism is a subject on its own. Racism is a very big problem in Chile and Latin America in general. Chileans are not used to black people. They have an extremely small black population. When I got to Chile in the 90s, practically nil. And racism in Chile and Latin America is different from what you'll find in the United States. People don't even recognize racism as a problem. They just think it's the norm. It's very hard to explain how racism works. I mean, when I hear even Americans talk about racism, I keep thinking to myself, you guys don't even know what racism is. I mean, in the United States, you guys have seen mixed race couples, right? You've seen a black person.
I'm in Canada, but of course.
But you've heard of a black person with a white person in a marriage or something like that, or absolutely, walking down the street. That's happened, right? Well, in Chile, I've never seen a mixed race couple with black and non-black person.
Wow.
Never seen it. I've asked even people about, have you ever heard of a Chilean in a mixed race relationship with a black person? Never even heard of it. So that's the level of racism we're talking about, right? Which is a very different thing when you're talking about racism in the US. And I don't know how to exactly explain, but I think that's a good kind of metric so you can kind of get an idea of how divisive race is.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so as somebody who's living in a fairly religious country, what is it like to be an atheist living in Chile?
It's strange because, like I was telling you, like people are now there's a lot of non-religiosity, but people do not say they're atheists. And to be anti-religious, to be an anti-theist like myself, and even to care about the subject about atheism and kind of move against religion is not common. And people do not go out of their way to call themselves atheists. I know in the United States, for example, in the West, people like to use to differentiate themselves philosophically between atheist and agnostic. Right. And I've noticed a lot of atheists can be very anal about these differences. And what is there? There's like Gnostic atheist or Gnostic agnostic and all this kind of philosophical subdivisions of it. In Chile, that's not what it means at all. In Chile, agnostic is just a polite form of saying you're an atheist. People just don't call themselves atheists. I have a lot of family members who will, you know, in public settings will refer to themselves as agnostic when they just don't believe in God. Even the current president right now, Michelle Bachelet, she identifies as agnostic, but really that just means atheist. And I've kind of, you know, because of all the work I do and because of like, this is a subject I care a lot about, I'll always say I'm an atheist. And I even got my father who is an atheist to kind of be more proud of it and kind of be more upfront about it, where he was very soft on the subject before. And I've been in situations where people ask, well, you know, what religion are you? And he'll say atheist. And I've seen people almost faint from him saying that.
Yeah.
So I'm the only person probably in Chile who goes as far as to sometimes call themselves an anti-theist.
No, by people, what do you mean by anti-theist? You believe that there is no God, or is it just anti-religion as a meaning?
Right. So in Chile, it's not a term that's even used. So atheist is ateo, and anti-theist, I'll have to translate it to antiteista, right? Anti-theist. And it's not a term people usually hear. Probably even in the States, it's not a common term most people probably hear. But in Chile, it's completely unknown. And so when people ask me, like, what religion are you? I'll say, Well, I'm an atheist, but not just an atheist. I'm an anti-theist. And I like to say that sometimes. Sometimes I'll just avoid the conversation completely because I'm just tired. but I'll actually try to say that if I'm feeling up to it, because a lot of times people will say, by atheist or by agnostic, what people mean is that they are not religious or they don't believe in God, but they don't really care about the subject of religion. Mm-hmm. And that really doesn't describe me very well. So I like to say I don't believe in God, but I'm also an anti-theist. And by that, and of course, everyone who I say this term to, they ask me, what do you mean by that? And I always summarize it to the fact where I'm not indifferent towards religion. I believe religion is a detriment to all of society and causes real harm, and we're better off without it.
Yeah, so that's what I totally mean agree, by yeah.
anti-theist. There's a lot of kinds of anti-theists, but that's what I yeah. I yeah. mean. I think in the Hitchens way kind of using anti-theist.
Yeah, I get that completely, yeah. And so, as you know, you're also going after the regressive left. I am too, by the way. I got into this. It's Christine's fault, by the way. she's the one that got me in looking at, yeah, good for you, looking at Steve Shives and people like that. I've been called an Islamophobe, but I don't care anymore. I mean, I think a lot of the times that people, the slur is meant to shame someone for talking about the problems of an ideology, which we know as Islam. Mm.
Well, Nazi is another one that gets very lightly. Yeah.
Oh.
And that's just the whole punching. I just wonder how
Nazis is crazy.
Well, and there's not Nazis anymore. There's neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
And, Trump's blah, 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 blah kind of thing. Well, I don't see any gas camps happening there, right? And how offensive is it to deploy that term in such a watered down way to the people that actually are, victims of the Holocaust and their families now kind of thing, right? Like,
oh, absolutely,
wow.
Yeah.
Using language like that is just taking away all the meaning and the power of it.
Yeah, it does.
I'm at the point where I really don't care anymore about that, because
you and me both.
You cannot care about it because you're never going to avoid it talking about the subjects we talk about, right? I mean, at least I talk about just Islam itself, just if I was to exclude every other subject and I'm just a critic of Islam, there's no way I'm going to avoid being called racist or Islamophobic or any of those things. You're never gonna get rid of it. I actually think some people who
actually
are,
uh-huh. I think we're calling out our own, right? Like, yeah. We're of course you're gonna get criticized by extremists, Islam extremists, for saying the things you say, but when the left starts calling you out and accusing you of being a Nazi and that kind of thing, like, wow, that's a different can of worms altogether, I think.
Yeah, but the whole point of being called that often is often a silencing tactic. From some people, it could be confusion. For example, being a critic of Islam, people not understanding that it's not a race, for example. Mm-hmm. But I know it is a silencing tactic from a lot of people, especially when it's used by Muslims towards critics of Islam. And I think almost one does themselves a disservice by even putting too much importance on it. I've seen a lot of, yeah, go ahead.
I think once you start deploying that kind of language, you've admitted you've lost the argument, because when you have to resort to that kind of thing, I'm sorry, you're no longer worth engaging anymore.
Well,
right?
It's an ad hominem.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, let it run off you like, water off the back of a duck, because it's ridiculous. But I still think it's important that we call out our own, because, like we're probably going to talk about here, it is often from the left that these accusations get hurled at us, right?
I actually think, but when it does come from the left, it's worth sometimes engaging those people.
Yeah.
But you should try to do it in good faith, where if they call you racist, for example, for talking about Islam, it's not enough to just say, well, Islam's not a race. Mm-hmm. You have to go into depth into subjects sometimes and ask them what they mean. For example, if do you remember when Ben Affleck called.
Oh, yes.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, but besides getting angry about it, if I had been there, I mean, and I had the chance to, you know, confront Ben about this, and I don't have the chance to confront Ben Affleck, but I have the chance to confront dozens of other people who say similar things. Mm-hmm. And so if I had been there when, you know, they're talking about Islam, he's saying, well, it's racist. I would ask Ben, well, what race do you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
What race what do these people look like?
Well, I think, right? You know, I think also Bill Maher and Sam Harris were kind of stunned by the reaction they got from him, because mm-hmm. it was so like they were being so clear that they weren't talking, you know, like, well, I think Bill Maher said, no, it's so not racist or something like that. He was just like taken aback that one would conflate a religion with a race.
No, but see, I think that's a mistake. They're getting on the defensive when they really, sometimes in that case, you need to go on the offensive and ask the person, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
What race? Because if I was asking him, I would tell him, well, look, Ben, I'm an Arab. I'm an atheist. My father's an atheist. And in origin, as Arabs, my family comes from Palestine, and my ancestors were Arab Christians, and were always Arab Christians, right? And Arab Christians existed before Muslims. So what do you mean it's racist? What race do you mean? Because I know he means Arabs. That's what he means by that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When he's saying it's racist.
Well, that's and the narrative.
I want to not just say, I think, you know, Bill Maher and Sam Harris might get a little lost in the fact, like, no, we're not racist. It's better to ask the person, what race are you talking about? Because if you start asking them in detail, what do you mean by that? And they start describing Muslims as a race.
Mm-hmm.
I find that very racist.
Absolutely. And offensive.
It is.
Because
absolutely.
What Ben Affleck is saying is that people with the, maybe with a last name like mine, like Dagash, he's saying, I belong to the Muslim race. Well, excuse me, I do not, right? My family is Arab in origin and nothing to do with Islam, ever. So what do you mean by this, right? What race are you talking about? Because you could use examples. You could say, would you describe East Asians as a Buddhist race?
Yeah.
Would you say that? And if you said that, don't you think that would come off as offensive to East Asians as describing their race as Buddhist? Because it's obviously not a race. So it's sometimes good to draw parallels, because I think people like Ben Affleck, they know what's wrong. If, for example, you said being Christian in America is equal to being white.
Yeah.
He would know that's very offensive, right?
Yeah.
He wouldn't. If you said being Buddhist is the same as being an East Asian, it's the same as being Chinese or Japanese or Buddhist. It's all the same thing. It's a racial thing. Like, he would know that's offensive. So you just have to explain. Well, there in the Middle East, yes, a lot of them are Muslim, but just like America, the majority are Christian. That doesn't make everybody in America part of the Christian race. And you're actually not acknowledging the minority religions in the U.S. if you just generalize all Americans as Christian. And you do the same thing with the Middle East. You're denying all these minorities who are persecuted, like Yazidi or Kurdish minorities, or Christian minorities who are constantly having to escape out of there, or Jewish minorities. You're not acknowledging their existence. And these people are all about acknowledging the existence of minorities. So you got to kind of play on the themes they like to use, if you know what I mean. Right?
Yeah, and then you throw the word culture in there, and that adds a whole new dynamic that one must challenge too, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
But you have to know who the good faith people are.
Yeah.
Because, for example, in the case of Ben Affleck, it's ignorance. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not that he's an expert on Islam and he knows what he's talking about. That was just pure and utter ignorance that when he got on stage. But then there's people who know what they're talking about and will
like
call you
Risa.
Racist anyway.
We're like Reza Aslan, Linda
Sarsour. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those people know exactly what they know what they're doing when they call you racist, and they know everything I said about Islam and the Middle East. They know.
Yeah.
They're just trying to silence you. So that person, I actually don't see much use in talking with them, with a person like that. with a person like that. Yeah, I wouldn't engage with them because it's I know that whatever I'm going to say to them, like these details, they know it already, right? They're just out to defend their religion, and they'll use the nastiest tactics.
But you still need to counter them because they are a voice that's being heard.
I mean, I counter them on, you know, in my way. However, I wouldn't try. I mean, I would almost give this as like this is a criticism towards people almost trying to have rational debate with people who don't deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't person like Linda Sarsour, if you were to talk to her one on one, she doesn't deserve rational debate because she's not going to come to you with rational arguments.
Yeah.
She knows these arguments already. Right. These things I'm saying, she knows it already. So why would I tell it to her? You should just counter the fact when to the rest of the people who are confused.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Audience is important. Right. Yeah. When you're disseminating anything on social media, you're not necessarily challenging the person that you're talking to. You're I guess, engaging their audience as well as your own. Right.
Mm. And can I highlight something, like, for example, Linda Sarsour? I get a lot of hate from Muslim apologists attacking me, saying you're not, they don't even say to me like you're not a real Muslim or something, because they know I'm not. I'm very upfront about the fact that I'm not a Muslim nor an ex-Muslim or anything like that. No, they'll attack me and they'll say you're not a real Palestinian.
Yeah.
So listen to what they're saying. You're not a real Palestinian. They're not denying faith or something like that. They're denying like an ethnic thing. You're not, and they're not totally being dishonest with that as far as what they believe, because to a lot of these Muslim extremists, to them, to be a Muslim and to be Arab are synonymous. They don't consider non-Muslim Arabs to be real Arabs, right? So when they'll say to me, for example, well, you weren't born in Palestine and you don't speak Arabic. Okay, fair enough, that's true. I've never lived in Palestine, I don't speak Arabic. But neither does Linda Sarsour.
Yeah.
Linda Sarsour was born in New York. Yep. I was born in California. Okay. Linda Sarsour doesn't live in Palestine and she doesn't speak Arabic. Ah, but what's the difference between me and her? She's a Muslim. So what they really mean is that, like, we don't consider you Palestinian because you're not a Muslim. That's what they...
But
that's
your
what their
ancestors
name.
Are from there.
Yes, but and they left why?
They left because they were Christian.
And my family did not leave in the middle of the 20th century with the creation of the Israeli state. They left in during the First World War under the Turkish Empire, where the Turkish Empire was ruling under Palestinians. And they were driven out because of Muslim Turkish persecution. And you guys have probably heard, for example, of the Armenian Genocide.
Mm-hmm.
The Armenian Genocide was a Turkish Empire imposition on Christian Armenians at the time. And there's a lot of other stories like that. So it was very widespread persecution. Now they bend over backwards screaming about the plight of the Palestinians. They never cared. They don't care today. Probably the best civil rights a Palestinian can have is in a non-Muslim majority country. They're not treated well, and they often don't even get citizenship in countries where they've lived multi-generationally. Right?
Wow. Hmm. Yeah, that whole, you know, I think you could probably go into quite a bit of detail on the Palestinian conflict in the, you know, West Bank or the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, let's skip that.
Yeah. Yeah, what a mess. I mean,
Randy, do you want me to switch to my computer, or is it fine with
You're fine on the phone. If you're on the phone right now, this has been good. Yeah, if you're comfortable with that, sure.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, yeah, the phone line, I've just put that up. You can phone us toll-free at 1-587-288-1067 or Skype me at the Legion. Oh, Legion of Reason. One word, Legion of Reason. It's on the screen. So if anybody's out there wants to comment, go ahead. Yeah, it's...
Are all of you ex-Christians?
I'm not.
No, I'm a lifer atheist, too.
Yeah, me too.
Like I said, your story very much parallels my own. And, You know, I was thinking, like, when you're talking about people describing themselves as agnostics, that's what my mom does. And my dad and I just, like, torment her. It's like, come on, you're not really an agnostic. You're an atheist. Just admit it, right? You know?
I wish more people
but
would.
But she thinks it's a softer term when it actually means something quite different, right?
I think agnostic up here is used to avoid confrontational situations. I think that's mostly what it is.
But isn't that, I mean, that's why, this is why one of the reasons I'm in this kind of, this fight or this thing, I really think there is
there's value to it, calling yourself an atheist.
I wouldn't go as far as to call it an oppression, but it's already, you know, a subtle oppression when we as atheists feel we can't identify ourselves in the correct way so as not to offend Christians or religious people, because they're not doing that for us. It's not like Christians have a
absolutely.
Softer word for their religion to not offend atheists. There is no instance where religious people ever in anything are worried about offending the feelings of atheists. Never for anything at all.
It's baggage.
For example, cartoons that offend the Prophet Muhammad. Or you're offending Christians. Never is there a news story I have ever seen where people are making a big deal out of, oh, these group of atheists were offended. No one gives a damn.
Oh, actually, right? I do remember a story, and it was not this Pope, but Ratzinger, right? And he had said something that was slugging atheists, and it was a Hindu community that stood up and said, hey, we don't want to hear this crap. And, you know, they defended the atheists. And I just thought, wow, that came out of left field, and that was amazing. This is probably, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. So yeah, every once in a while a religious group will say, hey, don't insult the atheist. And I thought, wow. But also my experience too is like very much like yours, where I didn't really, I knew about religion, that kind of thing. But when I went to grade one, I didn't do kindergarten. I met a religious kid for the first time. And I'm just like, oh my God, mom, what do we believe? And just feeling that sense of relief that my parents were on the same page as me and that I didn't have to pretend to them was how I put it. And as a consequence of that, it never occurred to me to apologize or just not, you know, oh, what's your religion? Oh, atheist, you know, or I don't believe in God or something like that. Right. Or humanist or whatever, you know, whatever the situation called for.
When did you discover the term atheist and start to use it? Because I actually didn't even have, I mean, I knew the word, but I didn't have it as an essential part of my vocabulary or identity until maybe in my first years of university when I started doing university in the United States and I discovered videos and articles by Richard Dawkins. And then I started to kind of consciously adopt the term of atheist and kind of put it out there when people were talking about religion.
I don't even know. It just seems it's been sort of a word that I've known for a very long time, right?
Not when you were really
I would say, right? Kind of like, you know, so when I went home after meeting that little girl in, you know, grade one, I said, you know, to mom, what do we believe? And she said, we're agnostic. And I said, well, what does that mean? And she said, show me and I'll believe. And so I was aware of the term agnostic, and somewhere along the line I picked up atheist, but probably in my mid to early teens. So like, my best friend in high school and high school was also an atheist and a gay man too. So we would often talk about atheism. It was just so normalized in my life. But humanist, like I remember first coming across the term humanist when I was probably in my early to mid-teens and thinking, you know, looking through the set of values, because that's actually a positive, you know, atheist just means you don't believe in God, whereas humanism asserts certain moral premises that I was like, oh yeah, this is me, right? Mm. So I think more profoundly, atheist, agnostic, we're just not terms that even hit my radar. It just seems to me I've always known them. Of course, that's impossible. And skeptic, okay, that's one that I also figured out when I was about, even before I went to school. And this is, I've told this story before, and I'm sorry if I'm boring anybody, but, you know, at Christmas time, you know, of course, you're getting advertised to constantly on TV. And, you know, being a little kid, I'm like, I want this toy, I want this toy, I want this toy. And my parents were like, yeah, you know, I'm going to ask Santa for this toy was my thing, right? My parents were like, I don't know about that. And so, you know, Santa brought me this toy, and it was a piece of shit just like my parents told me it was going to be. It broke in no time. Like, oh, I guess I really can't believe it, you know. And my family is involved in advertising and marketing, so there's also that perspective of being able to quite clearly see through the bullshit when you're being marketed to, or, you know, attempted to be persuaded to without rational basis kind of thing, right? So I guess those are the two words that I remember coming in, like, realizing before I realized atheism. Those just seem to be part of my, it seems to me, like I said, I've never not known them, but of course there would have had to be a time that they were introduced to me. And just like the word and, right, you know, or the.
Yeah, I actually dabbled a little bit with using the term skeptic or even humanist. I mean, of course, you know, you could also identify as a skeptic, and I do, and as a humanist, and I do, but as a replacement for atheist in that sense. I quickly discarded that and just stuck with atheist because I liked the instigating, triggering manner of atheist and the face I would get from people when I would say it, even in Chile.
Yeah, terror management theory in action.
Yeah, and yeah. I think there is, like, you know, all this kind of negativity around identifying that way. There still needs to be a normalization of that word. I mean, especially in a lot of places. I mean, even in the United States, it can be complicated. But imagine, like, Middle East. It can be, people
be deadly.
You could set people off even in Chile, in Latin America, saying this. So imagine, you know, places like the Middle East or Africa or Southern Asia and places like that where, I've talked with some people, for example, a friend in Europe, Omar Issam, who told me that he has friends, not acquaintances, friends, who he says he knows, without a doubt, if he told them that he was an ex-Muslim, they would kill him.
Wow.
Friends.
Wow.
So
who needs enemies?
There's a lot that still needs to be done as far as that word. And I think I've heard people try to say, you know, identify it in a different way. No, let's push that word.
Wow.
Yeah. And like I was thinking to you, like when I was a teenager, you get, you know, or, you know, even a preteen kind of thing, you get invited to your, you know, friend's family for dinner or whatever. And, oh, you're a guest. Would you like to say grace? And I'm just like, well, I don't believe in God. So, and, you know, people were usually polite enough because for all they know, my parents could have been Buddhists, like, you know, hippies, right? Like there was a lot of new agey stuff going on there. So most people were just, you know, polite enough to drop the subject right then and there. And you know, like, well, you're still our guest. Would you like to say a few words? And I just say, you know, thank you for having me here. And I'm grateful for, you know, the food I've got in front of me and blah, 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 very secular stuff. Right. And that was just, it never occurred to me that I might very well have offended those families and I would have been utterly oblivious to it. Right. But everybody seemed to accept me and nobody seemed to have a problem with it. And frankly, it wasn't until I, you know, was talking to Nate Phelps. Right. And he said, yeah, probably some of those people did think you were a demon. I'm just like, well, they were nice to me. So I never occurred to me that, you know, admitting you, you know, or whatever, just saying you don't believe in God it's just no big deal to me, right? Yeah. And when I realized that atheists were being, you know, essentially slagged for identifying with this term, well, that just made me think, okay, well, I'm sorry, I have no risk, and I will absolutely adopt that term and put it out there as much as possible. It's never been a secret in my life, and it made me, you know, just more adamantly want to define that way. But I also identify with skeptic and, you know, humanist and that kind of thing too. But they're all good to me, you know. Yeah. Those labels all fit.
Well, going back to my podcast a little bit, one of the reasons I invest a lot of time doing this, and I've been doing this now for over 3 years, and, you know, any money I get on Patreon, which is very little, less than like a couple $100, barely even pays for the websites and the equipment I use. So actually every month I'm still at the point where I have to put my own money into it. But I feel still compelled to do it. And one of the reasons is that I feel very fortunate about how I was brought up, where I was brought up without any kind of ideology pushed on me.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't appreciate for most of my life the freedom of thought that I was giving. It was it kind of, it, I find, how is this word? I'm sorry, I sometimes struggle to find words because I speak Spanish every day. But I find it unsettling sometimes when I hear that there are people killed for thought crimes.
Yeah.
Like in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Iraq or out, throughout all the Middle East, to the point where they could get killed, or sometimes they have been killed, for criticizing an idea, which is something that was never an issue throughout my life. I always had the freedom to think what I like and to explore what I like. And when I was very young and I'd ask my father about the universe and how things were made, he would sit me down and he, you know, I think much before the age of 10, I understand how a black hole was formed, right? And that's kind of a vivid memory I have. And then finding out that that's not the experience of most people, and hearing the crazy stories that they're that is pushed on them, and the way that they're not really allowed to evolve intellectually, it really hurts me. And we hear the phrase and the term thrown around a lot, privileged, right?
Yeah.
You know, this person is privileged, and that person grew up privileged. But I really do think, in this sense, I did grow up privileged. Not just compared to people in the Middle East, but people everywhere, people in Latin America, people, even a lot of people in the US. So when I hear and I find some of these people, especially the ones in the Middle East who are the most oppressed in this sense intellectually, and I interact with them, and they're such critical thinkers, and they have a disgust for everything that's kind of, you know, mythological stupidity in this sense, you know, and the ridiculous thing people do because of superstition, I get along with them so well. People who grew up in a completely different society, in a completely different way, and we just click immediately. And when I hear all the problems they have, and they cannot move around freely, and they cannot express themselves freely, I really feel compelled to help them in any way I can. And a lot of them want their voices to be heard. So I constructed, you know, an outlet and a podcast where I can kind of push out their voices as best I can, and I get to interact with them, and I learn a lot from them, which I think is fascinating. And if not, how often, or how many people in the world can really say they constantly talk with secular thinkers in Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Pakistan, all over the world, Indonesia, and I get to do that. And I wouldn't have gotten to do that without the help of social media and kind of becoming a little bit of a name there in the secular community online, which I feel so fortunate for, because before all this, I really didn't have anyone to talk about atheism and religion about. Not really. I mean, the friends I have are friends I have from high school or, you know, just around. None of these people care about religion. I mean, there's a reason you guys have probably never heard of another popular Latino atheist, right? I don't think you could name another one, right? There's not a lot of Asians, and there's not a lot of Latinos, if any, really. You can imagine, I don't have anyone to talk about this stuff with. I would just, you know, it was just a hobby of mine for the longest time, where I just watched some Christopher Hitchens videos or Richard Dawkins books and things like that. But now suddenly I start tweeting about it, right? I'm like, I have an opinion, I have something to say, and I start tweeting all day, and everybody in my life is angry at me, like, why are you on your phone all day writing on Twitter? This is a pointless thing to do.
No, it's not.
I mean, it's very crazy. Like, I went from, I actually remember at some point I was tweeting about all this atheist stuff at dinner at a Peruvian restaurant with my family, and my mother starts, you know, nagging me about, like, you're on this Twitter and, you know, this pointless thing. And then it was not but a year later that I was on Larry King. talking about politics, and it was because of, you know, everything I had done online, especially on Twitter. And then I told my mother, you told me, you know, all this stuff was pointless, and now look, I'm sitting across from Larry King, which was this extremely scary experience.
I bet.
You showed your ma.
My parents worry about my safety a fair bit, because I am quite outspoken and, like, very similar to you. So I understand where she's coming from. But, I'm not obviously as prominent as you, but I do make a point, like I am in touch with people from around the world like you are, and it's such a privilege to have those conversations. And very often, like especially lately, I've been sharing news items that people will share with me that they might be too afraid to share themselves, or, you know, and people sometimes say, I feel very alone here. And just to hear the words that, hey, you're not alone, like a lot of people around the world are totally on your side. And even people in your own society are on your side. You just don't know them because nobody dares speak, right? You know, you dare not even flirt with a woman in, you know, a lot of cultures. So, like, my goodness, you know. So
Dave Rubin just put up a conversation, an old episode he did with a woman from Iraq called Lubna Ahmed. And, I mean, she's, I don't know if you've seen the episode, but it's wonderful. He just put it back up yesterday. And she says her mother was an atheist. And so she's was an atheist her whole life, this secular woman in Iraq. And she goes on Dave Rubin's show, giving her name, showing her face on video. So brave. I was actually in Los Angeles with it was the time I was going to be on Dave's show for the first time. This was like almost 2 years ago now. And when he put up that episode at the time, immediately afterwards, she got tons of death threats. And they had to take down the episode. And I got to be around Dave and when he was interviewing me on that day, and freaking out and contacting people he knew in humanitarian organizations and contacts to try to help this woman. He takes down the video. Nobody hears about this woman again for years. And now she's in the United States. Dave says, you know, she lives just a few hours away from him. He put up the old video, and there's a new video up. But it's an amazing story where a woman goes on a, you know, 30-minute interview internationally in the States and just saying she's an atheist and how she's a secular thinker, and she has to escape the country because of death threats. It's just that's very sad, and it was very very emotional interview you could see there. So I try to do my little part as well I can for that. And it's really sad how mainstream media completely ignores these people and completely. Yes. You are not going to see, I don't know if you're going to see, but you have not seen at all women who have escaped from Iran, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, an ex-Muslim atheist woman who was forced to veil and now is a secular thinker who believes in atheism, who believes in science and rational thinking and all that good stuff and liberal values and feminism and all this, you know, against all this misogyny. You have not seen a woman like that on The View, on Oprah, on Ellen, on any of these shows. These are the biggest virtue signaling, pro-feminist, liberal, leftist kind of shows you'll find.
So they say.
You won't have those kind of... And I find myself talking to these women, telling me the most insane stories I've ever heard on my podcast. And I ask myself, why is this woman talking to me? This woman should be on every major liberal channel talking about her, these horrific experiences that not only she had, but that millions upon millions of women are having in dozens of countries across multiple continents, and it's just ignored.
Yeah, this is what drives me crazy about Linda Sarsour.
Well, the SPLC, CLA and Majid Nawaz on their anti-Islam extremist list. Holy crap. That is ridiculous.
But people like Linda Sarsour, who ostensibly claim to be feminists and look out for women, you know, that. But they'll have women try on veils. Oh, look how wonderful it is, blah, blah, blah. But they won't take that veil off in even a symbolic support of hundreds of millions of women.
You challenged that with a tweet, didn't you?
Randy, I did. Not just that. Yeah. I mean, don't even let her get off like that as being that subtle about her beliefs.
She actively
opposed a movie that Ayaan Hirsi Ali was helping to make called The Honor Diaries, which was specifically about honor killings of Muslim girls. She went out of her way to protest that video, that documentary. Wow. Out of her way to speak out against it and get it shut down, right? That's the kind of person Linda Sarsour is.
Yeah. So the idea that she's a feminist is ridiculous. And even just a job. But I actually watched a video a little while ago, last week or 2 weeks ago, with a woman and just a, you know, an eye slit was, and talking about feminism. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. How are you a feminist? I just don't get it. How do these people think that they're feminists?
I mean, and it makes me sad all around, because a lot of
they're
people
victims.
On the left who a lot of people on the left who ignore, you know, dozens of countries filled with millions of Muslim women being oppressed, they completely ignore them. However, when they do say about the right wing that they kind of use the plight of these women and they'll only mention them in passing,
mm-hmm.
to just say, you know, when feminists bring up issues in the Western world, in the United States, about the oppression of women, the right wing just says, well, what about Muslim women? There is a little bit of truth in that. That does happen. I've seen it. Because I talk about it so much on social media, I do see how some of the information and tweets and things that are going on are used that way, unfortunately. And that really upsets me, because then it's like, because the left is also ignoring them. You know, even if there's truth in the fact that the right wing is just using them, that doesn't negate the fact that the left wing is ignoring them.
Yeah.
Right. So it's everybody is ignoring them. Right. And the people who are sometimes giving them attention are doing it for not honest reasons sometimes. So and I don't just mention them in passing. I really try hard to engage with these women, learn from them. I'm always talking with them. I try to give them a platform on my podcast if I can. And also I kind of changed the way I use social media over the last couple years. When I was first on, I would, you know, like most people, you kind of just talk about everything. Any issue that's hot topic at the moment, you bring up. And I decided not to do that because I found it too time consuming. And it took time versus concentrating on one subject. I find it's sometimes negative to be a jack of all trades, right? It's sometimes better to be a voice for one issue, especially if you have a little limited time and limited resources. I'm not, I don't have anyone backing me. I do this completely independently. So I decided to be completely invested in one subject, and that is mostly the plight of secular thinkers in Islam, and that's what mainly I'll tweet about. And I start to avoid other subjects like Trump. When during the elections, I was very outspoken against Trump. I didn't really like him. I vote in the United States.
Yeah, me too.
Because I'm a citizen. So you were born in the United States too, so you can vote. Even if you're outside the country, you can vote. So I follow the elections because I out of civic responsibility. But once it was over, everybody's talking about Trump, pro or against. Everybody's doing it. Do they really need Lalo DeGosh in Chile to talk about Trump? I don't think so. Right. So I decided I'm going to pay less attention to a lot of subjects going on and focus on one where I think especially people are ignoring certain people and a certain issue.
Yeah. I almost never talk about Trump on here. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my main focus right now.
For me, it's about the harm religion does whenever it intersects with public policy in particular, where it has no business, and also the regressive left. I mean, it's very much a cult. I mean, the social justice movement used to be about real things, and now it's amazing. It's almost a cottage industry to come up with new words for new ways to be offended, as if I give a damn. It's this whole, I don't know, how did that happen? What happened? It just became weird. You know, mansplaining.
I have my ideas about it, but I think that's a long story. There's a lot of history. But I mean, to summarize, I would say that I think that the United States was getting much better as far as racism and racial problems and kind of putting aside identity politics and judging people by their race or their gender or sexuality in the case of gay people. But I think there was this stir of, I think racists on the side of the left gained a lot of power because they woke up to the fact that they can control society in certain ways because it became so negative to be homophobic or racist, because the stigma of that term became so damaging, they thought they could use it to their advantage and started to use it against a lot of people in a lot of groups. And there's a whole methodology there, you can tell us, that were very racist left-wing groups who didn't like white people for the most part. That's really what it is. Started to formulate a methodology to attack people where they say, you're racist. Even if you're not racist, you're in a racist system of privilege, so you're still racist. And I can't be racist because racism, I am now redefining it as privilege plus power plus blah, blah, blah. And so you put all these things together, but really all it is excuses. And also, so much of what the left is preaching right now, a lot of people think it's very new, right? It's very like new wave kind of thinking. Everything I hear from a lot of the extreme left these days, I've heard it all before when I was younger from the right. And you probably did too. This whole, like, for example, the whole video game thing, right? I mean, every argument that was being made, the sexualization of women in video games, the objectification of women, that violence. Video games can cause a person to become violent if you play it enough. All of that stuff was straight out of the 70s.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, every one of those arguments was said by conservative, right-wing, evangelical Christian house moms when I was young.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It was verbatim. And a lot of these arguments, the negativity towards sex, the hate towards Jews, the stigmatization towards homosexuals, a lot of this stuff now you hear on the left is straight out of the handbook of conservatives. I mean, this is why it's not mysterious that the left wing feels a connection to Islam, right? Because
that's a strange bedfellows, hey?
but it's not strange.
That's why I feel we're calling out our own
it's simply a misnomer of terms to think that left means liberal. Left doesn't always mean liberal.
That's and very
I know this
true.
As a person, yeah. I know this as a person who lives in a country, like I said, where there's a lot of communists. They're not liberals.
Yeah, no
they don't
kidding.
Believe in liberalism. They're the farthest left you can go. They're such a far left that you guys in Canada, the United States don't even have these people. You've probably never spoken to one, right? At best, you guys in the States, they talk about social communists. I got straight up real communists, real Stalinist communists in Chile to engage. These people are not liberals, but they're leftists. They're far left. Yeah. So. And sometimes they're very conservative. And a lot of these people are very, like a lot of communists can be extremely religious too.
Yes, Cuba is a good example.
Communists are not necessarily atheists. In fact, right. Most of them are not in Chile, for example. So the kind of left you have in the United States right now is basically a conservative movement. That's all it is. It's not. I hear this horseshoe theory about two extremes meeting. No, I say it's train tracks. It's two people on parallel roads. There's the conservative right wing, and these are just conservative left wingers. That's all it is. Everything they say, they're into racial segregation. They believe in modesty culture. Mm-hmm. They think video games can ruin your mind and make you into a violent person. Oh, the old school. Talking of conservatives back in the day about modesty and women should hide themselves and cover up and how that's a good thing. It's like the moral majority
of the 80s kind of thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Moral majority? I don't think so. I stepped away for a moment and I just wanted to mention, like, you talk to women in these closed societies, right? But I've got a public page and you know, a lot of the people that follow me or are friends with me are men in closed societies who, they can articulate the conditions of a patriarchal society extremely clearly. They're very concerned about their sisters being forced to marry off and that kind of thing, right? So I just find it really fascinating how many men I converse with in these societies very clearly understand about patriarchy, right? In ways that mm-hmm. I think North Americans could not express because, well,
what they think is a patriarchy, yeah, no.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, but, that's not to say that inequality doesn't exist.
Exactly.
And, blah blah blah.
And that's the binary thinking, right? The binary thinking is that, well, you don't think it's patriarchy, so you don't think that there's any sex discrimination. Oh, garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And we've talked about this too, like in terms of employment discrimination. Yeah. Yes, we have it on our books that you can't discriminate, with a woman's salary versus a man's and that kind of thing. But say you're stuck in a job and you dare not complain because you're going to lose that job and you're going to face 10 years of going down some road because the corporation's got a massive team of lawyers, you're fucked, right? So, yeah, that kind of thing still exists.
Well,
and that's a problem.
That's what I'm seeing now, that with all the accusations of sexual harassment or flat out rape.
The
Weinstein effect.
And it's not just that industry. We're only hearing about this industry, the sexual abuse that was going on, only because these all the names are major people that are famous and we know their names. If it was an unknown people, we wouldn't be getting this kind of news about it. But the truth is that sexual equality is not totally there in the United States. So it's very sad, actually, that a lot of the feminists in the United States who have been harping on for the last decade about patriarchy and the oppression of women had a point. They really did have a point. The problem is it got lost under a ton of other garbage.
Mansplaining.
And I saw the counter to crazy feminist ideals like all men are sexist inherently. All men are patriarchal. Looking at me in the wrong way qualifies as rape. Air conditioners are sexist. All this kind of nonsense. I saw how a lot of people said, "Well, no, all feminism is garbage, and actually, women in general are all equal." And immediately, I heard that. I knew way back when it started that wasn't true. Even a few years ago, 5 years ago or more, there was still the problem, for example, just on the subject of abortion. Yes. Abortion was legal in the United States, but there was all kind of nefarious things going on, especially in red states where they were closing down abortion clinics. Some states had no abortion clinic. Sometimes the ones that did were passing laws where women had to look at a sonogram if they wanted to get an abortion. All kinds of horrific stuff.
72-hour thing.
And those are women's issues. They're not egalitarian humanist issues. Those are specific to a woman's gender. It's specific to them. And that's why feminism, the rights of women, is a thing. Because we're not, I mean, we all agree biologically we are different. I'm not one of these, the crazy people who think
social
gender
construct.
is just a fluid thing. But because I don't believe gender is a construct, that's why I'm a feminist, because we are biologically different. Therefore, because our biologies are different, that means certain laws have to apply to our bodies depending on our gender, because men don't reproduce in the same way as men.
I would say,
sex.
Biological sex versus gender, I will grant that gender is the social construct.
That's a good way to point it. But that there is a difference there. And it's just sad. It's sad to me that I always knew that the feminist had a point. There was still a lot of things wrong in every country. Some countries way more.
Yes.
More things are wrong in the Middle East. More things are wrong, not as bad as the Middle East in Latin America. And not as many things are as bad maybe in the United States compared to a lot of places. But there was still a lot of bad things going on. And had they just concentrated on major issues like that, issues that everybody could get behind, instead of demonizing men, they would have gotten a lot more people behind them. Same thing with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter has a point. Right? A lot of a lot when it started, there was a lot of news stories with really bad shootings going on from police, and it was primarily of Black men, and that there was an issue there, a valid issue, still is. But on top of that, they loaded all this garbage on about Black people can't be racist and whiteness is a problem inherently and all white people are privileged. And then they started nitpicking everything is racist, and they started taunting every white person who had dreadlocks and punching them. And you know, there's a video of a Black girl, like, you know, grabbing and manhandling a white kid in a university because he had dreadlocks. Like, just nonsense like that. And then it's hard to get people on your side. But unfortunately, because they started harping on about all this nonsense, feminists, social justice warriors, Black Lives Matter, they lost potential allies, which is really sad. For example, in the United States, I used to live in the United States. I went to college there. It's not hard to get even white people to be allies against when you tell them the police are too aggressive. Everybody, like when I was in the United States, everybody knew that. The police are extremely aggressive people, even to white people. It's worse. Yes. I would say it is worse to minorities, especially Black people. But nobody wanted to deal with police. Nobody. Police are not. I never got the impression that police are especially nice to white people. They're extremely aggressive groups. They're.
Oh, oops. We lost him?
Well, I think we lost him. Huh? Did we lose him? Hey, Lalo?
Yeah, we lost him.
Did we lose
Come
him?
Come back!
I think we lost you, Lalo.
What a fascinating conversation.
Yes.
There's so many parallels, you know. And I was thinking, I was at a meeting in the U.S. and was chatting with a woman who's, you know, in a leadership role in the U.S. about these, you know, like an issue like man spreading, right? And I'm just like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I can't stand behind you with an issue like that. But goddamn it, when your reproductive rights are being threatened, I'm right there beside you, you know? Like, prioritize, right? Yeah.
We have Lalo back? I'm not sure.
Not quite
Doesn't
yet.
Doesn't sound
think.
Like it.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Can we bring him back in?
I'm trying.
Okay.
No, it's been a great discussion. I mean, it's echoes a lot of what we've been saying as well, right?
Yeah.
And
what an interesting international perspective, right? Because like, who thinks of Chilean atheist?
Yeah.
You know?
Chilean atheist. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the before 1988, it would have been pretty difficult to. Well, life would have been very difficult then. I don't know if Lalo was around back then. I guess he probably was. He must be closing in on 35 or so. But he would have been a child. He would have been a child. So in the Pinochet era.
Yeah. Okay.
And,
yeah.
Let's see.
Did you see his text?
I'm trying to call him now. Yeah. There we go. There we go.
Ah, there you are.
There we go. Good. Good. We got you back.
I had to. Something is wrong with my Wi-Fi, so I'm on my. I'm in Chile, so I'm still on 3G. By the way.
Ouch.
Developing country still.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I'm sure the infrastructure has actually been pretty damaged from recent earthquakes as well.
No, not at all. Chile is great. No, after the earthquake here. So little damage.
Oh, really?
I think it was in the 70s that the earthquake codes got really good in Chile.
Okay.
Since then, if there was an earthquake, there was very little damage, and there was the earthquake that was, how many years ago was it? 4 years ago,
something,
was it?
Maybe 3. Maybe.
Something like that? 3? Maybe. I forget. But something like that.
Me too.
It was almost a 9, and there was very little damage to Chile.
Oh,
and
really?
And even Haiti's earthquake was about 2 or 3 points less than Chile's, and their city was
Leveled,
practically totally leveled. But Chile just has really good infrastructure and good codes when it comes to earthquakes.
Yeah, up here in Canada, we just have to have codes for snow buildup on the roof. So that's pretty much it. We don't have earthquakes much.
The island is part of that fault line, right?
Yeah, they get the occasional little one, right? Like, yeah. I think four is about the maximum.
Yeah, I think we had a big one maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
That's, well, yeah, no
damage. And people, like, I didn't feel it myself, but people here in Calgary are saying, I felt the tremors, right?
Oh, I didn't feel
nothing. That's pretty, okay.
I didn't even know. I don't remember any earthquakes from when I lived in California, so that was a daily occurrence.
Everywhere I've lived in my life, I've lived in California, Chile, and Japan.
Oh yeah, right? Ring of Fire.
Everywhere I go, there's earthquakes. I can follow me around.
Yeah, you lived around the rim of the Ring of Fire, pretty much. And
yep.
It would probably today get on my nerves, but I'd get used to it pretty quick, I think. You know, California.
Earthquakes?
Yeah, earthquakes in California? Just a daily occurrence.
Yeah, kind of, but I'd be kind of pissed off having to, like, clean up my glass that fell from my
They're not most. They're mostly not anywhere near doing it. You know, they're not damage-worthy. So they're just, you know, might, you know, rattle the china, and that's about it.
Yeah, I have family down there, and shit breaks and blah, 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 you know. Yeah.
You get used to it. Yeah. Where were we?
So let me ask, what is your guys' show about? What does it concentrate on?
I think it pretty much concentrates on everything we've been talking about here. It's, you know, we talk mostly about Canadian issues in terms of the intersection of religion and public policy. And its effects on it. So one of my hot button topics is medical assistance and dying. And I think it's a time that, or it's an issue that whose time has come. And we're seeing it in so many parts of the world right now. And we have...
So are you referring to the right to euthanasia?
Yeah, to, you know, voluntary. Uh-huh. And we have a lot... Catholic Church still has quite a bit of they're loud anyway. And
can I point out something?
Sure.
Because of the Catholic Church in Chile, we only got the right to divorce in Chile.
Oh wow!
In 2005.
Wow.
2005.
Wow.
Well, with your grounds. Okay, so that's there's divorce, worse. Like, say if you're, you know, your husband's beating the shit out of you or blah, blah, blah kind of thing, as opposed to a non-fault divorce? Are you talking about non-fault divorces?
No. In Chile, before 2005, there was no law of divorce at all. The only people who could get separated was if they could get an annulment, which wasn't that common. Not everybody could get an annulment. I even had an aunt... who had two children in a new marriage and two children from an old marriage, but in her new marriage, she wasn't married to that guy. She was still married to the previous husband because she wasn't able to get an annulment. There was no divorce.
And that was because of Catholicism, a lot of people. Influence of Catholicism.
Because of Catholicism. And that, when even I studied in junior high and high school here, it was something that was discussed a lot. And I remember even classmates would say that they were against divorce, the law for divorce, because they, and the typical argument around me was, and they would hear on TV and from all the Catholic people, was if they allow for divorce, then everybody's going to get divorced, right? It'll just spiral out of control.
And so
right, that was the reasoning. But
who cares?
So when you hear that, for example, Muslims, you know, it's very complicated to get a divorce, but at least sometimes they have divorce. Imagine in Chile, a very
developed country. It's not complicated. You just have to say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and you're pretty much done, aren't you, if you're a man?
No, but only the male.
Yes.
The male, yeah.
Privilege. Yeah. we have here in Canada, we have Catholic school systems that are publicly funded.
Uh-huh.
And we also have Catholic hospitals. And guess where all the palliative care facilities are. And you can imagine the problems that we're having now, now that medical assistance in dying is legalized. There's these Catholic hospitals where the boards, you know, Catholic bishops sit on the boards. Guess how many medical, you know, made requests are granted in a Catholic hospital? They have to, even just to be assessed, they have to be taken to another hospital, which, you know, public hospital, and things are done there. I mean, these some of these people are in incredible amount of pain. I mean, the talk about increasing the level of suffering, and this is this has real effects on people. You know,
suffering.
Get rid of the Catholic hospitals. Just get rid of them.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I get very tired of hearing a lot of people say that there are no problems with Christianity at all anymore. It's tamed and it's been enlightened and secularized and it's an advanced religion and all this nonsense. Or there's even now a movement of people saying that we need to go back to Christian values and all this nonsense. Utter bullshit.
Yeah.
It's still Christianity. The only time when they're pointing out that it doesn't do harm is in the least religious communities of any place. Yeah. But anywhere you look in any country, whether it be Chile or Africa or even the United States, in communities where they are more religious and more fundamentalist about Christianity or any subdivision of it, whether they be evangelical or even, you know, other sects like Mormonism or things like that, you'll find infinite amount of bad practices, harm, real patriarchy, homophobia, abuse, discouragement of using
condoms,
any kind of condoms, sexual preservatives, opposition to abortion, opposition to a divorce, everything. You'll find everything. And those are the people who have the strongest Christian values. And people are saying you need to go back to these traditional values. Yeah. Utter nonsense. And it's also nonsense that Christianity has been tamed. You'll find crazy stories. Like in the United States, I hear it happens quite often that a child gets something as simple as pneumonia and the parents won't take him to a hospital because they'll just pray over him to get better until the point where he dies. And some of these parents have gone to jail. Right.
I contend.
And there's some crazy stories you can imagine in Latin America still, which is entirely much more Christian than you'll find in the United States. Do these people think that they don't have problems with in very Christian communities? That is not caused directly because of Christianity. Yeah. I mean, even just the fact the Catholic Church opposes so vehemently condoms is a source that you'll find, especially for example, in Brazil and a lot of parts in Central Africa, tons of people still getting AIDS.
Yes.
That causes extreme harm or death. And we're talking in the millions still.
How can they not see the blood on their own hands is what blows me away.
Yeah. So I don't have any patience for people saying that Christianity is this tame, benign thing now in the West. No, it still causes a ton of harm. It's never been good. It's not good today. And any examples of the Western world being advanced is where you'll find the least religiosity anywhere, even in the United States.
This conversation reminds me of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and I'm not even sure she's still doing this, but she was saying, okay, let's introduce Christianity into some of these Muslim areas because it's had that reformation, right?
No, she doesn't do that anymore.
That's a bad idea.
All the arguments, and that's kind of old Ayaan Hirsi Ali. This is Ayaan's position of like maybe
10 years ago,
more than 3 years ago, I think. Yeah. I heard her say that multiple times, and that was out of all the things she said that I really liked. That's what I never liked about her saying that solution to this is converting them to Christianity. But she moved
I do understand the position she's coming from, but I disagree with it. Like, do away with it altogether.
It came from an ignorance of Christianity, I think.
That Christianity is no different than Islam. Christianity is no different than Islam.
It's very different.
It's adherence.
And Islam is
You don't see people throwing gays off buildings in the U.S. or in Canada.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. It's the adherence to the religious principles that doesn't exist in the U.S.
Even the murder of homosexuals happens still in Christianity.
Yeah,
it happens exactly.
But it is illegal.
It happens in Asia.
Not because of Christianity.
That's a good point. Not because of Christianity. Yep. Any rights that homosexuals do have is not thanks to Christianity.
Exactly.
But
some Christians would disagree because they like to take credit for things that other people, you know, the more they become, I've said before, like the degree to which a religion is tolerable is the degree to which it's been secularized.
And that goes for individuals as well. Like when I hear people describe a good religious person, he's such a good liberal Christian. He never goes to church. He never reads the Bible. He's hardly religious. He barely believes in God. He's such a great Christian. I never hear a person say, oh, he's a great mathematician. He never reads about mathematics. He's never taken a course on math. He hardly ever reads about math. He's a great mathematician. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
But that's how people describe a great religious person.
I have to share two experiences, and they're very similar. One gentleman I met had, he had raised his children as what he perceived to be good atheists. And bloody hell, if one of them didn't start, going to some evangelical Christian, faith, writer. He's like, I'm so disappointed in my son because I raised him as a good atheist. And, and then I had another friend that said something very similar. And the kids had gone toward the more Catholic end of the family, I guess. And he's like, I tried to raise them to be. So it's very interesting, like, that I've heard those couple of things, right? Like, because usually it's the opposite,
Like, can I address something? I'd like to address something that Randy said, though, about Christianity and Islam being no different. There's a lot of harm caused by both still, but they're not the same. And it's good to remember that everything that makes them different, every harm they cause, is because of a doctrine in the religion. For example, there are things that are better in Islam sometimes than in Christianity. Most of the things you'll find about illiberal societies, Islam is, and Muslim majority countries do generally really bad in. But some things they don't. For example, there's about 6 or 7 countries in the world where abortion is completely illegal on every level. And every single one of those countries is Christian. Not a one of them, even in Islamic theocracies, is abortion completely illegal. Right?
Yeah, so, that's a fascinating topic. Yeah.
And Chile used to be like that. And Chile, which is the most developed country in Latin America, was one in Latin America, 2 of those 6 or 7 countries that were abortion was completely legal. And when I say completely legal, this is important to highlight to the level it's illegal, because I think people don't understand this. In Chile, when it was illegal even if the woman's life was in danger.
Yeah.
So if the fetus was like in the fallopian tube and was going to grow there, which could kill potentially the mother, it was illegal in Chile. And doctors would technically still abort in those cases, but very under the table.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they would do it in those cases. Yeah. But there was one case of a woman who the fetus was growing stillborn it was developing without a brain and a heart, I think. Aww. So it was not alive at all. She was forced to bring that child to birth. She wanted to get an abortion, and it was a famous case because she was a journalist. So she described this whole situation happening, and it was the most painful. It almost made me physically to hear that a woman had to go through that. Right.
And
that
not to mention, like, bringing a child in that's not going to survive for more than a few hours or maybe a couple of days, like, that's fucking cruel too. When you can take care of the problem.
So many levels.
Yes.
So many levels. I mean, it's not even the decision of the mother, because in the United States, maybe those fetuses that will, once they're born, might last only like a day or a week or something. If it's their decision, good luck to, I feel for them if that's their belief. But in Chile, it's not even the woman's decision. So imagine knowing this child that is not alive and it's not going to be alive. You're forced for it to grow inside. It was just, it was mind-boggling, and I found it to be disrespectful for the plight of women having to be the child bearers. Do you know what I mean? And men putting them in that situation. And
insufferably cruel. And insufferably cruel, not only to the woman, but to the child, too. And probably the father, too, because, you know, who wants to see their family go through that kind of, you know, trauma? And I'm reminded of that case in Africa where, Ireland, where she was a Hindu woman and they refused her an abortion, even though it was inevitable that she would die. And she did, you know, along with the fetus and, you know, leaving behind a devastated father, right? Wow. That, like, how insufferably cruel is that?
But so the differences you find in the religion, why you'll find more countries that oppose abortion to that level are Christian versus Islam, or the reason you'll find it in Islam, why there's jihad or why they kill apostates. That's because of the doctrine in the religion.
Well, yeah, right? But that's the same doctrine that's in Christianity, though. The difference I find is in the adherence. I mean, when you have something, a religion that considers the scripture not just like Ken Ham, where it's literal, but that it is holy and cannot be questioned, whatever it says in there, no matter how heinous, you do it. I mean, if it tells you to kill apostates, it'll kill apostates. But Christianity is the same
thing. Well, that's two different things, though, Randy.
Yeah.
But, Randy, that's two different things to say adherence and it's a doctrine.
It is two different things. It is totally two different things. That's my point.
But, right. Right. So, like, for example, in the case of Judaism, it's a doctrine that they can't eat pork. Now, adherence, sometimes they do eat pork, right? But I would never – but you can't say those people who do eat pork, that eating pork, therefore, is a part – of Judaism, or that it's okay in Judaism to eat pork because there are adherents who eat pork. No, even if there are Jews who eat pork, it's still not allowed in Judaism.
Yeah, I agree. Right?
It's still a doctrine that is forbidden. So adherents don't define the religion. They might.
No, I'm
not
making that point. I'm saying is it goes back to the original statement I made that Christianity and Islam, if you take a look at the actual scripture, They're pretty bad. They're both really bad. It's just that the adherents of one take it, as Sam Harris would say, more seriously than, say, the United States. I mean,
they take it more seriously because there are more rules. For example, this is even a difference between different kind of Muslims. For example, you probably heard the difference between Sunni and Shia.
Yes.
Right? These are two branches of Islam. And you probably know that Sunnis are more fundamentalist and more strict in their religion than the Shia.
Yeah.
Now, why is that? It's not just a thing where they became more secular. It's because of how the religion is structured in different branches. So so you probably heard that, like, the difference between Sunni and Shia is because the lineage of who took over Islam as its leader after the death of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yes.
But there are also doctrinal differences. So, for example, in Sunni Islam, they believe that anyone who was alive at the time of the Prophet who was a Muslim, whatever that Muslim said, it can be used as an example of how to define a rule in Islam. Any Muslim who was alive during the time of Muhammad. Shias believe differently. They believe that only those closest to Muhammad, they can be considered as people that you can look to follow their example as rules for Islam. Not every Muslim who was alive at the time. Now, you can imagine the immense difference there are going to be there as far as rules. So Sunnis have tons of different Muslims to look at as far as when they ask themselves, what do we do in this case? Sunnis have more people to look at. Shia only have the Prophet Muhammad and the Sahaba, or the companions of the Prophet. That's all they have. So when they don't have an example of a person to look at, they have to make it up for themselves. They have to, well, there is no rule, so we can make up our own rule, right? Mm-hmm. So there's less rules that are defined by the religion. Mm-hmm. So when you say that those people live much stricter way, it's because there's more rules for them to follow. If there wasn't those rules, they would be free to pick and choose, and they have to decide with their own cognitive critical thinking skills.
Yeah.
But when you have the Quran and endless amounts of rules, and and especially in Sunni Islam, everything in your life is defined, right? They have a rule for everything. How to go to the bathroom, how to wash yourself, how to put on your pants, how to walk through a door. Things that it was pretty much incomprehensible to me, but there's even branches of Islam where it's not that strict. Like I was saying, like Shia, and even there's less stricter Islam than even Shia. But these are defined by the amount of doctrine.
Ahmadiyya, is that how you say it? Ahmadiyya Muslims are fairly well persecuted in other... Yeah, thank you. And yet here in North America, they're quite peaceful. They do blood drives, and which is also fascinating because there's a lot of religions that don't want you to, I guess, share a part of your body, like, you know, donating blood or donating organs or even receiving these things, right? So
I could tell you horror stories of things that you haven't even heard in Islam that are done by, for example, Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yes. Yeah.
For example, Muslims do not have the rule that you cannot do a blood transfusion. That's not part of their religion. It is part of Jehovah's Witnesses that you cannot do a blood transfusion, correct? Yeah. And this applies to their children as well, and doctors have to respect that fact. So not back up in here. The day, it, but not there?
No.
They don't have to respect that for children?
No, children's rights supersede parental rights.
Yeah, courts will always side with the doctors on that.
Yeah, best interest of the child, right?
In Latin America, I told you before my mother was a nurse. There was a time in Chile, this is not done anymore in Chile, but there was a time when if they got a patient who was a Jehovah's Witness and they couldn't do a blood transfusion, they would just put that person to sleep and give them a blood transfusion without their consent.
Yeah, because they don't have to ask consent from an unconscious person.
Yeah,
exactly. But now they don't do it because now it's like the United States where you could get sued really badly as a hospital if you did that. But back in the day, it was more, you know, we'll just give him a shot, put him to sleep, and we'll give him a blood transfusion.
Yeah, but there was a case and the problem at hand.
But there was a case a while ago of a woman who got a blood transfusion, and her little child, who maybe was 3 years old, they both got blood transfusions while they were put to sleep, right? They were Jehovah's Witnesses.
So to speak.
So when the mother woke up, she saw the chart, the nurse, she shouldn't have done that, but she wrote on their chart that they had gotten blood transfusions. Mm-hmm. The mother saw that she and the child had gotten blood transfusions, so she took her child in her arm, jumped out the window, and killed herself on the child.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Wow.
Like, that's one of the most horrific stories.
Yeah.
That's one of the most horrific stories of religious dogmatization of the mind that a woman would do something like that I've ever heard, even in comparison with Islam.
Wow.
And it's not something that would happen in Islam. Why? Because of the doctrine, right?
I want to go back to, can I go back to something that you said? You know, we were talking about different sects of Islam. And oftentimes there's this whole thing that people say terrorism isn't about Islam, et cetera, because Muslims kill other Muslims. But my contention is that the Muslims who kill the other Muslims aren't seen Muslims. They're not Muslim to these first Muslims, and vice versa.
That's a really easy fallacy to break. For example, Islamic terrorism isn't about Islam because Muslims are killing other Muslims.
Yeah.
Except that the Muslims killing other Muslims are doing it because those other Muslims belong to a different branch of Islam, right? It's Sunnis killing Shia or Yazidi or things like that. The way the Sunni Salafis of ISIS treat Yazidi women, turning them into sex slaves, they wouldn't do that to Sunni women, mostly.
Because they're perceived as apostates, right?
But you guys probably know of the conflicts between Ireland and the English with the Protestants and the Catholics, right?
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, of course.
Yeah. So what would you say to a person who told you, no, that conflict shows that it wasn't about religion because those are Christians killing other Christians.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you would tell them, well, okay, but you simplified it to Christian and Christian.
Yeah.
But obviously this was, in part, there was a political element to it. There always is. But a huge divide in that conflict was Protestant and Catholic. Mm-hmm. You can't just simplify Protestant and Catholic to Christian as if that division didn't exist And you cannot do that for Islam either. Yeah. Right. And yeah, and most exactly. Muslims who say that, who say that kind of thing, they know that division is there. They hear in their mosques how horribly Shias are talked about. They know it. That's just
it's lip the dawah
service for Whitey, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it's dawah. Yeah, it's evangelicalism for white America, really naive yep. leftists.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Again, we return back to that problem, right? Yeah.
Until we solve it, we will.
Well, we'll just keep speaking out until, like, every day I see more of us on the same page, and it inspires me. And I know it inspires my followers who are in those close societies. They see my postings, and they don't feel so alone. Every day we feel less alone. Every day we take on more of the risk collectively. And the more we do that, the more we're going to succeed.
Yeah, if by inspire you mean piss off, yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Well, yeah.
I get really pissed off when I read stuff like that.
Me too. You can use reason, and that's going to appeal to some people. And you can, you know, put your voice out there and be more assertive or be satirical or, you know, there's different voices that are going to appeal to different groups, right? Or to different people, right? Yeah. And so, you know, yeah, there's, you know, I've heard this argument a million times, like, oh, we should be nicer in how we approach things. Yeah, okay. That's fine. But, you know, like somebody like Bill Maher, who just puts it out there, or, you know, they have a voice too. And, you know, sometimes for people, leaving a religion is a matter of years. And sometimes it's a matter of, like, just getting that cognitive slap upside the face
sure.
The whole house of cards falls down, right? So
there's also a cultural difference there. Arab society and Latin American society is actually very similar in a lot of ways, besides the religion. Like, it's a very family-oriented society, very superstitious society. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of similar things between Latin American and Arabs. And being Latin and Arab, you know, you get the best of all of it. It explodes in all of that. But Middle Eastern cultures, they're not politically correct and soft-spoken and vague. For example, this way of talking, of saying, well, I don't know if I'm right, and, you know, everyone has their opinion, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but what I think is
culture
about
relativism.
Islam,
well, culture
that, but
relativism.
Also just,
yeah.
The way of speaking, also, to being too vague about what you believe. Mm-hmm. Muslims, or even Arabs and Middle Eastern society, they don't talk this way. They're very absolutist in when they talk. Right. This is why they sound like they're very fighting. They somebody walks into a room like that in a Middle Eastern society, all vague, like, oh, I don't know, but maybe, but like that. No one's going to take them seriously.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of the atheists who speak too softly and too trying to be politically correct towards Muslims actually get nowhere. This is why you'll find that some of the most respected atheists that have created ex-Muslims and apostates in the Middle East is especially people like Christopher Hitchens. Because Christopher Hitchens, he walks into a room and he's so sure of what he says and so poignant and very aggressive in how he points it out with total conviction, right? No ifs, ands, or buts. It's like this. And even if a Muslim disagrees with it, he respects the way of talking. Because Muslims are not there in their way of talking. They're not in the mosque saying, well, maybe there's an Allah, and, you know, well, the Hindus have their opinion and the Christians have, and this is our, no, that's not how they talk. So when they hear a person speak with certainty, they respect the certainty, at least, even if not what they're saying. So people who are too soft are not often going to appeal to people in the Middle East. So when people say, we just have to be nicer and you just have to put it softer and you're being too aggressive, you're talking for your culture. And not every culture is like that. And Latin American is not like that either. For example, there's no word for compromise in Spanish.
Okay.
There's no translation for the word.
Like, I guess I'm looking at the variety of communication styles, and there are the soft-spoken people who might change people over 10 years. And then there are the mocker, you know, people that will outright mock. And you know, like I said, flip that switch and, you know, turn that brain around 180 degrees immediately as opposed to the long. And I think all those voices have, you know, right across the range, have an important role to play. You know, so I'm not going to be critical of people who mock religions. I'm not going to be critical of people who say, oh, don't. Well, I'm going to be critical of both, frankly. But, you know, like mocking religions has its place. Not mocking religions and treating people with respect has its place. It depends on how you uptake a particular communication.
Right? I totally agree with you. Yeah, like there's the people who do the street epistemology technique of just kind of asking Peter questions. Out of their people's religion without giving your own opinion. Almost
Socratic
at all.
Socratic dialogue.
Especially,
right, the Socratic dialogue. Like, I'm not, I sometimes use that technique, but for the most part, I'm very outspoken about my opinion. I'm not going to just sit there and just kind of ask questions like, no, I think this, right? So, but I appreciate the people who do use that technique, and some people are very good at it, and they can get very far in a conversation, but it's just not my way of talking. I wouldn't be able to handle just suppressing my own views and opinion. So
I could probably, well, I'm like, I don't know. I'm very, what would you call me, Randy? Everybody perceives me as being sweet. And some people have used that word to describe
conciliatory? That, conciliatory? Is that a good word for you?
Well, I don't know if I go that far, but I try, right? But I'll take it to a certain point and then I'm just like, no, sorry, wrong, you know? And then I'll, I can be quite nasty even, right? But it's a last resort tactic.
Please, please give me a break.
Oh, I've been pretty nasty, you know, but it I have to be driven there, right? You know, and I'm just like, okay, my hackles are out, right?
So are you are you saying like you're very nice, but when the person reaches a point of total stupidity, then you're just like, no, I'm not having it.
Exactly. Respect, you know, nuanced dialogue, I'll participate. But once I go off the deep end, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
I've never seen this. This is completely outside of my experience of you.
I did screen captures in that, you know, conversation where I completely turned things around, you know, like it was all about, oh, political correctness. You can't say this and you can't say that and blah, blah, blah kind of thing. Right. And, you know, I finally got, I don't know, to the point where I'm like, you know, I was talking about the Holocaust and Holocaust and how, you know, one must step up and defend, you know,
Harvey
the
Weinstein.
Meaning of it. No, but like, you know, like the Holocaust is a real thing. And when people say, oh, you can't interfere in other cultures and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm sorry. When it comes to, you know, people.
Oh, colonialism.
You know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. I'm
that
just
bullshit.
Like, you know what? Yeah. No, I can't sit there and, you know, no, I can't criticize other cultures. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm obligated to criticize when people are being anti-Semitic. And you are the one who is trying to turn it on me. Right, to be, you know, the bad person. I'm just like, I felt really bad about doing it, but I'm just like, look, I just turned this whole thing right back around on you. And how dare you not speak up for these kinds of issues, right? Like, oh no, I'm not gonna speak up because it's not very nice. But goddamned if you don't speak up, then you're being an asshole too. So I you know, yeah, I'm sure I showed you the screen caps from that, Randy.
Probably. Yeah.
This is the kind of mentality you're talking about, Christine, right?
Yeah.
Christine. Like the kind of mentality you're talking about is actually very pervasive in Chile, at least. And this is one of the reasons, like, where in the States, I would have a lot of problem calling myself a feminist because of the political stance of a lot of feminists in the US. But in Chile, I might be considered like a fundamentalist, radical feminist, because so many women I talk to who even identify sometimes as feminist, not often, like there's not actually a lot of women who I would call themselves feminists, but a lot of women, when I talk to them and I talk about, for example, Muslim women or something like that, they themselves will hold the position like women deserve equal rights, women deserve the right to abortion, all this stuff. But when we talk about women, for example, in the Middle East, like, oh, it's just their culture.
Yes.
Oh,
you know, cultural relativism.
Yeah. Like they,
that's
drives me nuts.
Yeah.
So I asked them, like, do you think that we here in Chile or anyone else in the West, people outside of those countries, should be pushing and talking for women to have the rights that you want? And so many women will tell me no here. So many.
I know.
That happens up here,
like,
too.
It's one thing if you're incredible. In a culture where, you know, like I live in a culture where we eat our salad before dinner. And some cultures eat their salad after dinner. Like, that's not a, you know, harmful issue. But when it comes to, like, FGM or something like that. Yeah, there's, you know, you got to, you know, stand up against that kind of practice because it's causing suffering and harm to people,
yeah.
Right? Whether you eat your salad before or after dinner is completely, who gives a shit, right? It's interesting, but nobody cares. But, you know, when it comes to harm, people being harmed, you're, I think, in, you know, in my opinion, you're morally obligated to speak out against that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's where, like, I wouldn't even push myself to the point where I'd say I'm pretty radical feminist in that sense, that I do think that rights of women supersede any kind of belief or culture. No, women everywhere deserve not just equal rights, because equal rights doesn't really, for example, in Saudi Arabia, if women had equal rights to men, they still wouldn't have human rights. Correct?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So actually, when people say, like, oh, women deserve equal rights, that doesn't really, sometimes women will say, like, you know, feminism is about equal rights. Well, if men don't have human rights, you know, equal rights won't help you. So even in that sense, it's not really the same. So I would say, no, people deserve humanist rights everywhere, and women sometimes have the least amount. And yes, like, for example, organizations that have the letter on human rights that they have describing what they consider to be basic human rights, I do think those should be imposed by international organization on every country. I think it's ridiculous that Saudi Arabia is on the Human Rights Council, for example.
Oh, they should stay. Yeah.
No, there's some,
that's a joke.
There's some basic rights,
a funny one.
There's some basic rights women and people in general need to have, and if they don't have them, you're outside of our club. I think the UN should have that attitude and position, but they don't. And I'm of the opinion that they should. They should say, no, either you give these people certain rights, like, not, you don't have to be a Western country, right? You don't have to have every right, but there's certain rights that we consider basic that you have to have. I'm of that opinion completely.
Yeah, and I think they're fairly well outlined, maybe not perfectly, in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And if you don't want to abide by that, why the fuck are you on that? You know, why are you part of that, right? I have to excuse
myself. I have a sneaky suspicion that Saudi Arabia has been pushing to be on the Human Rights Council, not let alone leading it. It has to do with blasphemy laws. That's my suspicion.
I think Saudi Arabia wants to improve its image to the world, so they're making like symbolic concessions. And the Catholic Church did the exact same thing when they changed popes from Ratzinger to Francis, Pope Francis. That they it's an aesthetic change; it's not a real change. The Catholic Church did not become progressive overnight with that new pope. It was just vague declarations of progress, not any real.
Yeah, well, I'm not actually sure change. How progressive he is. Yeah.
I don't think he is that as progressive. As,
not as much as the media has made it out to
people
be.
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that he's been a little bit misquoted, but misunderstood. I mean, as much as the Pope can be misunderstood, they all misunderstand me. Yeah. Well, too bad.
I think Saudi Arabia is trying to do something similar, where they're trying to show symbolic concessions to the world. So they'll because people are talking a lot about Saudi Arabia lately, and they're getting a lot of bad press. And if you make certain small concessions, maybe they'll shut up.
There's something seriously going on there that behind the scenes, I have no idea what it is yet. But it's some serious stuff.
Yeah, we kind of have to wait and see there with Saudi Arabia.
Wow,
their countries work very differently from the West still.
Yeah, very top down.
There's a lot of tops, though.
Yeah, that's true.
For example, I've had a lot of dialogue with people from the United Arab Emirates, and not just like random citizens. Like, I've had the opportunity to talk a little bit with Omar Sharif Ghoubash, who's the author of the book Letters to a Young Muslim, and he's an ambassador for the Emirates to Russia from there. So he works for the government of the Emirates, right? And I've talked with some other people, and some of them are in governments, actually. And they like me. it's a very interesting thing. They actually like my opinion on Twitter, and that goes to show you they're extremely secular. And actually, a lot of these people are very outspoken against the the moms and the sheikhs in their own country. And they can't just arrest them because they're very powerful. They have lots of followers, but they are very outspoken against them. Like Omar Sharif Ghoubash says a lot of negative things about very popular imams and the bad things they cause in his country. And I've seen videos where he says the same thing. So even when you talk about the top, there's the government, and you'll find there's actually a lot of secular people in these governments. And then there are the imams and the scholars of Islam who have their own power that they use against the government. And there's a battle going on there that we often don't hear about. And it happens in a lot of these countries. So there is a lot of headbutting going on in the Middle East that we don't even know about, that I've only discovered through my own investigation and talking with these people. I never would have heard about most of these things from the news. I don't think most people even know it. I just, you know, it's something you just discover from talking with people from there. Actually, a lot of people in Arab nations are not really, they don't even care about what's going on in the West. And a lot of people have told me that they get nothing out of talking with Westerners, right? And they get very frustrated. A lot of ex-Muslims in Egypt and other countries have told me that talking with people in the West is just frustrating when they try to explain Middle Eastern politics, Islam. It's just so ignorant in the West of it that to try to explain any of it is a big waste of time for them. So they just stick to their own problems and talk amongst themselves and write in Arabic and talk with other Arabic speakers, which we don't get translations for and we don't hear about a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a quagmire in that whole region is just one, you know, it's quicksand. You know, if you start getting into the politics there.
They're going to have a lot of still fighting, a lot of things to work out. And unfortunately, the rest of the world is caught in the middle of it.
So, yeah. Well, if it wasn't for oil, I don't think anybody out here would care.
That's a fair thing to say. Yeah.
Actually, they hardly care even now.
But we're talking, you know, I'm talking about the political interest. I'm not talking about the general citizen. I'm talking about governments. I don't think governments would care if it wasn't for them.
Well, governments are driven often by industry and that kind of thing, right? So hence their policies will reflect the fact that they've been bought out by certain industries. And some political issues will be ignored and others will be given inordinate attention, right?
Yeah, but are people much better? Do people much more? Like, you say like governments don't care unless there's like economic interest. But
or national interest. Yeah.
I mean,
But I think
even people on the left, when they talk about Venezuela, I see mostly apologetics for the government of Venezuela and Chavistas and Nicolas Maduro, basically the dictatorship.
Yeah,
it is a dictatorship. Venezuela. Yeah. They sympathize more with this dictatorial regime more than they do with the citizens. And these are people on the left, not the right. The right don't like the left-wing government of Venezuela.
I guess that would still show some sort of sign of caring about the issue, even if it's misguided.
Lip
right?
service.
Yeah, well, lip service or just being misdirected, right?
I know a lot of the people who do care about the issue and speak out, but they're speaking out in favor of the dictatorship is because there are a lot of left-wing fundamentalists, for example, Noam Chomsky, or a Canadian woman, Naomi Klein. These are people who are, you hear tons about Naomi Klein and
really
Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore and Oliver Stone and Sean Penn and all these hardcore leftists in Latin America. Naomi Klein comes to Chile and Latin American countries to endorse hardcore left-wing, sometimes communist groups, because they are fundamentalist, leftist, anti-globalist ideologues, basically, which is really funny now that I mean, in the recent months, I started to see that right-wing America is starting to identify as anti-globalist. I mean, to me, that's insane because I I've been studying about the people like Naomi Klein, who's a self-identified anti-globalist and hardcore left. I mean, anti-globalism was a left-wing position for years and decades, and now the right-wing are taking it up. I'm not even sure what that means.
What does it even mean to be anti-globalist?
It means different things to different people. Yeah, to Naomi Klein and Noam Chomsky and Sean Penn and Michael Moore, it meant to them that anti-globalism meant America and Western countries, and especially capitalist countries, because that's the common factor with all these people.
Yeah,
Michael
Moore,
evil. Oliver Stone, they see the great evil as capitalism, right? Neoliberalism. They hate capitalism. They're basically either hardcore socialists or communists.
But and to be a globalist doesn't imply that you're necessarily a capitalist.
Well,
it could just be that you care about people in other countries and their human rights.
Well, the older definition of globalist was an economic position mostly. For example, there's a book by Naomi Klein that's called The Shock Doctrine, where she basically makes the argument that capitalism has destroyed many developing countries in the world. And she said, basically, capitalism was the reason for suffering in Chile, Iraq, and Russia. Now, imagine the kind of thinking you have to think that capitalism is what hurt Russia or Iraq, that the problems they have is because of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But that was her position. And now, interestingly enough, the anti-globalist position has shifted to be anti-immigration, which is a totally different subject, right? It's not the imposition of capitalism.
Yeah.
It's to be anti-immigration. That's what right-wingers in the United States mean when they're anti-globalists, is that they believe in the isolationist theory of countries to stop immigration, right? Trump, more or less. But
like
Trump is
nationalism,
not
almost, right? Think about Europe and how it's raising its... Yeah.
And even Trump is a little bit anti-globalist when it comes to even economics, remember?
Well,
when
so
it comes
says.
To
totally own sources so, of
yeah.
jobs, right?
Well, that's what he was selling, at least, I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's not, maybe it's not his attitude, but he was very anti economic diversity with China and Mexico, et cetera. Whether he did it or not is a different
American
story, but I'm saying that's what he was selling. Shifting a lot of politics in the last few years, I found.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone all over the map here.
It's been so much fun, too.
Which is good. I like these kind of self-directing conversations because, you know, they just flow.
I hope I don't talk too much because
on
my podcast, I let everyone else talk all the time. So when I get the opportunity,
you're the
guest and shine.
Nobody wants to hear me all the time. I mean, you're the guest. That's why you're here. It's to add things to the discussion, and I've certainly learned a few things. I've been trying to get you on the podcast for a while. You probably don't even know it.
I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
I had no idea. Just when I saw that you were interviewing Yasmin Muhammad
I'm typing get on their podcast.
You want to know something funny? I'm always shocked that anybody knows who I am. When you were like, oh, Lalo's here, I was like, why do people know my name? I'm still absolutely shocked that anybody would know who I am still.
It's a weird thing to me. I know.
I want to ask a favor. I can't seem to find you on Facebook, Lalo, so could you friend me? Or semi.
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
Thank you, because we are obviously
go ahead.
We obviously have very common interests, and
definitely.
Yeah, the more we ally with multiple voices and give those voices a platform that can otherwise speak for ourselves, if we can share those kinds of things amongst each other, I'd be thrilled.
Well, and Christine has
send
a pedigree.
The link to your Facebook.
Yeah, Christine has a pedigree. She was. The president of Atheist Alliance International.
Yeah.
Oh,
and I'm
really?
On the,
that's awesome.
Yeah, and I'm on the board of directors for the American Humanist Association. So I guess
a few people
know me, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Me, I'm just a nobody.
Oh, if I could point out one last thing before we end, because I I want to just talk about a little that I did this week. Probably one of the most fascinating, interesting interviews I ever did for my podcast that won't be out tomorrow. It's a different podcast, but it'll be out the week after, which is, today is the 13th, so it'll be around the 20th or something like that that I'll post it. It's with a woman named Stephanie Tessier, who's a Francophone-speaking Canadian woman who converted to Islam. She married into it. And it was the first part of her life, because she wasn't a Muslim, was very regular. But then she marries a Muslim man. She has two daughters with him. And then, I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie Not Without My Daughter with Sally Fields, that was based on a true story about Betty Mahmoudi, where she had a husband who was Iranian, took her to Iran for vacation, and just they're stuck there because they're not allowed to leave unless your husband gives you permission, and he wouldn't give permission to leave. And I've discovered there's a lot of women still who are going through that situation today. She married a Muslim man of Libyan descent, and he said, I'm going to do a doctorate in France. And said, I just want to stop on the way in Libya to visit my family. And when they got there, he said, you guys, we're not leaving. You guys are not leaving from here. I want my daughters to be brought up Muslim in a Muslim country. And she couldn't leave. And they couldn't leave because the father in Islamic theocracy has absolute control over the wife and the daughters, even though all of them, including the husband, were all Canadian citizens. He was also a citizen of Libya. She wasn't. She's not Libyan. But because her husband is Libyan, the daughters automatically have Libyan citizenship. She is under the control of the husband. They couldn't leave. And this is during, she's there with her daughters during the revolution in Libya when they killed Gaddafi.
Yeah.
So she's in Libya with her daughters. She can't leave. And she's in the middle of a civil war. And it just gets, she tells the absolute insane stories. And the ending to that story is heartbreaking. I won't say it now because it's very complex. But to suffice it to say that she's in Canada without her daughters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not of her own decision, which is very important to highlight. She did not leave knowing it was going to be without her daughters. And she can't go back. She cannot go back into Libya without the permission of her husband.
Oh,
and she doesn't have it. So this Western countries don't work the same as Middle Eastern countries. Eastern countries, you cannot leave without the permission of a husband. And she cannot come in to the country without permission of her husband. It's a heartbreaking story, crazy stories. And this happens to a lot of women, where they get trapped in a Muslim majority country against their will. I highlighted that because I was just fascinated myself in the conversation. It's just so sad too. And she also, at the end of the conversation, she points out how disappointed she is in feminists and the left. I asked her about that.
Yes.
How do feminists react to you? And she said, most feminists or LGBTQ people or leaders were, she said, they'll sooner side with my husband than me because I'm critical of Islam and Islamic culture. And she said, for example, at the that there's a LGBT parade, I think in Canada around where she lives. And she says, said, I used to go, but she says, I can't go anymore. I'm totally for their rights, very progressive rights, liberal rights, but she supports them, but they don't support her and everything that's happened to her. And because it's so heart-wrenching and terrible what happened to her, she just can't be around people who are apologetic towards that society, Islam, and her husband. And
speaking of deplorables, those are the deplorables.
Yeah.
I mean, they're terrible people. They're not even good people. I can't stand when they make excuses for, I don't know. I want to grant
some graciousness of ignorance or something like that. But I agree. You know, I have little tolerance for that kind of shit. you know, your apologetics to its worst instantiation, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So I'm very critical of Islam, but unlike a lot of people on the right that just demonize everyone who lives under Islam and is Muslim, I only have infinite sympathy for those people, and I just want them to be empowered and change their countries for the better, not just isolate myself from all of them. Because you can't isolate yourself from the rest of the world. The people who are under the impression that they can just isolate themselves from Islam and ISIS and extremism and that part of the world are delusional. The world is globalist. There's no, having an anti-globalist position is ridiculous because it's trying to stop a tsunami over your head with your hands, right?
Yeah.
You can't do it. It's not a solution to stop globalization. It's there. It already happened, actually, right? So you now just have to, the best bet is actually for those countries to develop. And the best way for those countries to develop is the empowerment of civil rights and especially women's rights.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, that kind of works both ways, you know, the globalization, that we're exporting Western ideas, you know, to these areas.
Absolutely. A lot of these places, that they don't even receive movies or TV shows or books, or, you know, a lot of them have limitations on their use of the internet a lot of the times. I mean, if you just look into how important social media was for the Arab Spring in Egypt. I was reading a book by a guy named Wale Goyim, who wrote a book called Revolution 2.0 about the Arab Spring in Egypt. The whole book is about Facebook. And every chapter, he's just going on and on about how Facebook groups and his interaction with people on Facebook and the Facebook groups he created, it's all about social media. This entire two-thirds of the book is that. So social media and the interaction with the rest of the world, that it's so important. It's not just people who want democracy and going on the street. No, a lot of involvement comes from the internet and us outside. And I mean, so many ex-Muslims, there, when they talk about why they became ex-Muslims, not many of them are naming some atheist writer in their country. They're talking about Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and you know, or atheist chat groups where they're interacting with atheists in the West who are not afraid to speak their mind. Right. So it's so important.
And her CLE will cite the Nancy Drew series as being very influential in her life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes I get kind of pissed off because, like, people will often say, oh, I can't solve anything globally, so I'm just going to focus on local issues. No, there are so many opportunities to translate, to, you know, offer your legal skills, your design skills. There's just, like, so many avenues to help, right? Even if it just means sharing news items on Facebook that here in the West we might not otherwise see. Give people a voice. You know,
I mean, my podcast, that doesn't get tons of listens, all right, but it gets, you know, it does a little bit okay, you know,
whatever.
Well,
it's going to increase more and more as, you know, we all speak out, we're all going to be listened to.
But on SoundCloud, you can actually check the city that your podcast or your audios get the most listens by city. Yep. And it was like a couple months ago that I checked where the city that was getting the most listens to my podcast, and it was Jakarta.
Wow.
Interesting.
The biggest Muslim country in the world. I was like, I have fans in Jakarta. This is where I'm getting most of my listens. I never would have guessed that. Never in millions.
Same on my Facebook page. Like, you know, I've got American followers. I've got, you know, some Canadian followers, but so many of them are from the Middle East. And I think it's just amazing that I get the opportunity to speak to these people and, you know, make some small difference. You know, I can do the best I can, right?
It's a real privilege to talk with all the people I've spoken to, these, like, the women in Saudi Arabia.
And the men, in my case, it's not many women follow me. I'm sorry, maybe I have a nice photo or something like that, but, you know, it's mostly men. And they're, mm-hmm. like I said, they're well aware of the patriarchal situation. They're concerned about their mothers and their sisters and, you know, daughters, not so much because I'm not attracting. I mean, my goodness, there's a lot of people that just simply can't find partners. Right. And, mm-hmm. and, they're virgins well into their 20s, maybe their 30s and that kind of thing. And that,
that's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how are you going to flirt with a woman in those societies? I don't even know what she looks like under that garb, right?
I mean, a lot of some people have told me that the only women they interact with up until the age of 20 is sometimes just like their aunts and cousin in their household, and that's it.
Yeah.
And they've
yeah.
never interacted with a woman besides that. I mean, that's just begging for bad sexual development, right?
Yes.
When there's no interaction between the sexes, right?
Yeah. And total ignorance on how to, I guess, you know, the natural biological imperative to couple and reproduce. Like, those opportunities are just not there for so many people. It's unbelievable, you know?
I mean, and also, I don't think it's actually even talked enough, the importance of sexual repression in these extremist societies. I really think that sexual repression and ideological extremism and abuse towards women and all mm-hmm. those things is so related to sexual repression. I mean, these societies, men and women are segregated.
Uh-oh.
I think we lost him again. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Did we lose him again? We got him back. He's still there.
And even masturbation... Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you. Yeah. Okay. We caught the word masturbation. There you go.
Right. Masturbation is, I was going to say, is discouraged in those societies. So imagine, as two West men, could you imagine never interacting with women, not having access to pornography, and being discouraged from masturbating well into your 20s? I'd probably put a bomb on my chest, too, at that point, right? This is not normal behavior for an adolescent male. They're not programmed to repress sexuality in that way. And if you do, I can imagine it creates a lot of frustration, which leads to anger, which leads to resentment, which could lead to fundamentalism and all those things. So the repression of sex is not something that you hear talked about in intellectual circles when it comes to Islam. It's always like, ideology and politics and socioeconomics. Sexuality is the driving force for so much of what we do. If there weren't women in the world, honestly, Randy, would you go to work or clean yourself up really or buy nice clothes?
No, of course not, especially guys. I mean, if it was the reverse, women will.
All day.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly
that
what I do. I work here, right here, and I spend most of the day in a house coat. I look, you know, I'd like to say I look like a
Me too,
a
but that's because we're lucky we can, you know, telecommute or whatever, right?
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
You know, I want to point out that I had a young man contacting me on Facebook and, you know, like something, I'm, you know, taking a great risk contacting you. And turns out to be, you know, slightly older than my daughter or whatever. And he's like, I feel so guilty because I'm watching porn. And I'm just like, dude, there's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly natural and normal, right?
And so, it happens in non-Muslim societies as well. I've been investigating a lot into Mormonism because I have a friend who I work a lot with, Jennifer Sutton, who's an ex-Mormon and an ex-Muslim, but she was born into a Mormon family. And she's been encouraging me to research more Mormons and Mormonism and ex-Mormons and all of this stuff. And of course, the sexual repression is extremely heightened. It's very comparable to even the most fundamentalist Islamic communities. And what do you find? Of course, lots of sexual abuse, very common. So those almost always go hand in hand, is the sexual repression and religious fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely is do you have religious fundamentalism without that repression.
That's the ultimate control. That's what religions are all about now. Maybe they didn't start out that way, but that's what they're doing now.
Mm.
Controlling behavior, controlling people. Yeah,
indeed.
Anyway, well, I think we should probably sign off now. It's got to be almost midnight where you're at in Santiago.
I'm a night owl anyway.
Or night owl. Yeah, I kind of am too. Yeah. I don't get up early. I don't have to get up early tomorrow. Yeah. We're going to be doing, you know, so much for the weekly thing. We're having another vidcast tomorrow with a atheist pro-life person, and that person's Christine is going to, not this Christine, but another Christine, is going to try and convince us that we should be pro-life as well. I don't hold out much hope for that, but whatever. You never know.
I suspect your position is more nuanced than,
than a Catholic one.
You know? Yeah.
So
it's interesting.
It's going to be very interesting. So we'll see how that goes. And sure. Yeah. So we're good back again less than 24 hours. So
yeah.
Well,
thank you for very much for having me on.
It's been fantastic having you. We'll have you on again, I'm sure. And we'll.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. We'll get on to some more, maybe more focused topics next time. Yeah.
Mm.
Great. Awesome. So I'm just going to close it out then, eh?
Right. You've been listening to the Legion of Reason Diversion coming to you from Alberta, Canada. If you enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing to our bi-weekly podcast on iTunes and other podcatchers. Even better, subscribe to our YouTube live sessions where you can join in on the discussion. Thanks for giving us a listen. Music and other sound effects under license from audioblocks.com.